bombshell development buried deep in the House Armed Services Committee's draft for the Fiscal Year 2027 National Defense Authorization Act, Section 224 establishes the so-called United States-Israel Defense Technology Cooperation Initiative. It demands the Secretary of Defense appoint a dedicated executive agent to synchronize U.S. and Israeli efforts across artificial intelligence, cyber operations, biotechnology, quantum computing, autonomous systems, directed energy weapons, and missile tech. This isn't a partnership. It's a technocratic fusion with calls for bilateral R&D, co-production of weapons, joint ventures, licensing deals, network integration, and full data fusion. American military secrets could soon flow directly to the IDF. This initiative builds on decades of over $200 billion in U.S. taxpayer support to Israel, but takes it to unprecedented levels by embedding Israeli influence directly into the Pentagon's decision-making and industrial base, creating co-production facilities on U.S. soil, generating jobs that lock in congressional support, while handing Israel leverage over American defense priorities. Data sharing and network integration raise massive red flags for espionage risks and the loss of strategic autonomy. Transparent American oversight would be a relic of the past.
They're taking it off budget and nesting it inside the classified ledgers of the Pentagon, which last time I checked, if you add it all up, there's over $15 trillion been stolen or disappeared starting in the mid-1990s until now. And of course, they just failed their audit again. In it, and I've got the subsections here, it says that Israel's funding and military operations will just go into the classified divisions of the Pentagon, and then through those mechanisms, you don't even know how much money they're going to get. And they're calling it partnership with Israel on weapons and so and security so and intelligence. So that's why Netanyahu's like, hey, we want to wean ourselves off of Washington. Oh, Israel's going to get off our tit. Nope, sorry. Israel is going to literally slice us open and crawl inside our belly and just feed inside our stomach itself at point blank range. So Israel's not going to just be hanging off the hind tit now. Israel's going to, like a face sucker, plant an egg in our stomach, and then it just feeds inside our stomach till it grows up to a big enough level, and then boom, 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 punches its way out and comes out and says, here's Johnny.
As this technocratic fusion advances, it will further enforce Israel's reach into suppressing American dissent amid a wave of new laws and the outsized role of dual citizens in rewriting the rules of our Constitution. With anti-BDS measures already embedded in numerous state contracts and federal proposals, and broader efforts to equate criticism of Israeli policy with anti-Semitism gaining traction, this deepened military-industrial integration creates powerful new levers. What begins as cooperation risks becoming a framework where questioning Section 224 itself triggers accelerating the criminalization of dissent under the guise of national security. Most of us assumed America First meant no secret mergers, especially mergers undermining the military and the will of we the people. Section 224 must be ripped out of the 2027 NDAA post-haste. John Bound reporting for the Alex Jones Network.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. This is War Room Live. I'm your host, Harrison Smith, coming to you live on this first day of June 2026. Hope everybody's doing well. We got, of course, big weekend full of news to go over. Major developments in the Iran war, but, you know, I mean, what I should probably do would save us all a lot of time. I could record about 10 or 15 minutes, and we could just play it every Monday morning, right? I could do 10 or 15 minutes where I go, last Friday, there was talk of a ceasefire. It was looking like it was all about to come to a peaceful conclusion, and then Israel started bombing Lebanon, and then Trump backed out of the deal, and now we're right back to square one. If you play square one slightly behind square zero, which existed before we started this war, I could do about a 10 or 15 minute little, you know, keep it a little bit vague, keep the details a little bit, you know, inexact, And we just play it every Monday morning because we're in Groundhog's Day hell world, essentially. So we're going to go over what has unfolded with Iran, Israel, and America. It's not that complicated. It's nothing new. It is the same thing that's happened over and over and over again for the last 93 days of the Iran war. It's Israel tricking us into a conflict and then making sure that we cannot get out of it for the life of us. And the way in which they're guaranteeing that we stay in the conflict is by having, well, they're just killing Lebanese people by the thousands. That's essentially it. That's the entire conflict in a nutshell. And I got a lot of videos to get to today from a lot of topics. A lot of them are a little bit longer. I'm still going to try to get to them because in addition to everything going on with Iran, and I'll try desperately against all odds to actually lay out an efficient timeline for you as to what exactly happened with Iran. But also we need to, of course, talk about what everybody over the weekend seemed to start to understand, yet we've been reporting on this for several years now at this point, and that is the wholesale collaboration merging, essentially, of Israel and American militaries. Now, we've been talking about this for a long time, certainly ever since Tom Alexandrovich, the head of the Cyberdome security program in Israel, got arrested for trying to meet up with an underage girl here in Las Vegas and then was let go by the Israeli-born judge that just let go Ori Solomon, the Israeli citizen who was caught creating a lab. Because when Tom Alexandrovich was arrested, we started looking into who he was, what his position was, and he was the international liaison for the Digital Dome system that Israel was trying to sell to NATO, Five Eyes, Germany, and other European countries. And this, you know, I thought that's where it would stay for a while. They've gotten more ambitious, but essentially the Digital Dome program was folding the cybersecurity for the nation of America or Germany or England or any of the Five Eye countries into the security umbrella of Israel. And this is extremely troubling. Well, now they're codifying it. They have a congressional bill put forward to solidify and actually literally merge the Israeli and American militaries, which is just insane, but it's not in any way exclusive to America. This is actually happening in European countries all over the world. So again, I'm glad people are recognizing this. I'm hoping that it's not too late to throw the brakes on and stop this from happening. I do think everybody listening to my voice should probably be calling your congressman and telling them that you're not happy with the new addendum to the NDAA, Section 224. And we'll get into that. Again, I'm glad people are doing investigations into this and finding the exact ways that this merger is taking place. But this has been a very, very long time coming, and it has to do with not just the military, but the technology that our military operates on and the way in which Israel already has essentially embedded itself in our big tech companies like Palantir, which is serving as the foundational operating system for so much of our military. It's already happened more or less through the corporate side. Now they're just trying to codify it. But it's a lot deeper than even people realize. And again, it's happening in every European nation simultaneously. So this is from Tony Saruga, Deep Dive, The Quiet Coup Inside the NDAA. The Responsible Statecraft piece has put its fingers on something genuinely significant. And the fact that this is happening inside a must-pass $1.15 trillion defense bill buried at Section 224 tells you everything you need to know about how the permanent national security apparatus operates when it wants to avoid a public fight. What Section 224 actually does. This isn't a tweak. Section 224, titled the United States-Israel Defense Technology Cooperation Initiative, is a structural rewiring of the U.S.-Israel military relationships. The provision authorizes $150 million annually, but the money is almost besides the point. What matters is the architecture it builds. Bilateral R&D, so bilateral research and development across AI, quantum computing, autonomous systems, directed energy, cyber biotech, counter-drone system, and missile defense, co-production and joint ventures with Israeli defense firms on U.S. soil, licensing agreements that embed Israeli-origin intellectual property into Pentagon programs of record, network integration and data fusion, which means U.S. military data flowing into Israeli systems and vice versa, pathways from R&D straight into procurement, bypassing the normal foreign aid oversight channels. The key phrase in this legislative text is technologies are to be identified for integration into United States systems and programs of record. That's not foreign aid. That's making Israeli defense tech a backbone of the Israeli military. And of course, what is the quote that Alex always references? It's when the head of the ADL, Jonathan Greenblatt, giving a presentation to the Israeli Knesset, says we must use the genius like we used in blowing up the pagers to destroy Hezbollah. You know, in our war, in our Eighth Front war, which is a war against the New Rome, which is America. And so do you think it's a smart idea to give the people who used their hijacking of a supply chain to take over the technological supply lines of their enemies and then use them to blow up their enemies? Do you think it's smart to put those exact people in charge, essentially, of our military supply lines? Again, it feels absurd to argue any of this. It's just an attack. It's just an attack. I swear to God, I feel like I have to get up here and be like, you know, like imagine being, you know, a person during the Blitz in World War II in Britain having to get up and be like, I think we're under attack. Guys, we're being bombed continuously. Germany is bombing us a lot. I think they're our enemy, and I don't think we should trust them. And then having a bunch of people in the UK being like, oh, shut up, fearmonger, anti-Germanist. It's crazy. It's crazy. That's pretty much where we're at now. What's happening with this Section 224 is the equivalent of a bombing raid against the United States, only it's significantly more damaging, but a very similar attack on our sovereignty, just, you know, happening digitally rather than physically. Here's Jonathan Greenblatt talking to the Israeli Knesset, using the pronoun we, as he talks about how we must end a war, you know, wage this war, not just on the battlefields, but just as importantly, on the internet as well. Let's watch.
We've got to start doing things differently. And the same goes here in Israel. This means that the problem won't be solved by yet another new Knesset task force. It won't be solved by the government just throwing money at the problem. It won't be solved by the IDF spokesperson's unit issuing updated talking points or suddenly using TikTok. Like us in America, you need to adopt new strategies, to experiment with creative tactics, to study the results and scale what works. Maybe it's a whole new IDF unit, call it 8300, to lead this fight. But we need the kind of genius that manufactured Apollo gold pagers and infiltrated Hezbollah for over a decade to prepare for this battle. We need the kind of courage that executed Operation Deep Layer inside Syria and destroyed Iranian missile manufacturing capabilities to undertake this mission. This is the kind of ingenuity and inventiveness that have always been a hallmark of the State of Israel, that have always been a characteristic of the Jewish people. I know we can do it.
We, right? We can do it. We, the Israelis, he says, cosplaying as an American, as he serves on as the head of the unelected Jewish Oversight Board, the ADL, who has, by the way, basically had veto power over anything getting published in America since at least the 1950s. Remember, they've been around since 1913, coincidentally enough. So again, you know, one of the things, like the guy Alex was interviewing, Handsome Truth, there are like a lot of these people. You have to like really understand this. You have to really study this stuff. And one of the things, when you actually study this stuff, that you come to understand is that the current situation is absolutely in no way new. We have been under essentially the same regime for 100 years. If you're going to overthrow a century-old, you know, banking cabal that runs the world, you're not going to do it by yelling at people on the street. That's just not the effective strategy here. You have to understand who it is you're dealing with. And it's one of the funny things that I find with people that, you know, have yelled at me for 9 years, calling me a Jewish agent or something, because I'm strategically more intelligent than them, they can't comprehend the angles I'm taking, is it's like you study the Jews 12 hours a day, 7 days a week for 10 years, and you didn't pick up any tips? You didn't figure out what it was about their strategy that's been so successful this whole time? You're convinced that they are running a 3,000-year-old global, you know, conquering strategy, and you think to defeat them, you should yell on the internet. You think that's the thing. That's going to solve the problem, really? It's not. It's not. It's a step towards solving the problem. Under the Pentagon procurement model, this is back to the post by Tony Saruga, funding moves through budget justification documents and programs element description and program element descriptions. Oversight is limited to cost readiness and capability, bureaucratic criteria. The relationship gets evaluated like any other weapons program, not as a strategic political commitment, no diplomatic strings attached. As Responsible Statecraft notes, this would give Israel a, quote, higher level of military industrial integration than the U.S. has with any other country in the world, including NATO allies. Not even Five Eyes partners have this kind of embedded access to U.S. defense procurement. And again, if you think that is troubling, that's happening here in America, what about this? Military cooperation of the Netherlands with Israel is inappropriate. The Dutch parliament will discuss a treaty on military cooperation between the Netherlands and Israel with Defense Minister Ollengren. According to PACT, it is incomprehensible that the Netherlands wants to cooperate with Israel militarily and calls for an end to this cooperation. Israel has occupied Palestinian territory for decades, annexing it, expanding illegal settlements, driving residents off their land and demolishing buildings. This year alone, over 100 Palestinians have been killed. Over and over again, human rights violations and war crimes are committed in the process. The debate in Dutch parliament centers on so-called status treaty, which regulates the legal status of military personnel on each other's territories. But how can the Netherlands justify cooperation with Israeli military responsible for aforementioned crimes? Again, folks, it's not really all that complicated. It is kind of horrifying that they're, you know, coming out like this. I was joking with Alex before the show about like covering up for Israel. And it's like, there is no cover-up anymore. They're just doing it. They're just doing it, and they're basically saying you're not allowed to stop them. That's what's happening. There's no cover-up anymore. They're sort of just doing it, and they want it to happen quietly. But if you find out and are mad against it, what are you going to do? What are you going to do about it? Because they're just going to do it. And they don't care. And, you know, they know it's bad for you. That's why they're doing it. So how are you going to appeal to them? Like, wait, no, but we don't want this. It's bad for us. They're like, yeah, we're Germany bombing London. We know it's bad for you. This isn't a question. It's an attack. But literally, we're here suffering under the Blitz and saying, you know, some people say we're being bombed. Yeah, we're being bombed. Yes, we're being taken over. Yes, this is an attack. Yes, it's going to succeed unless you stand up and stop it. No, you cannot ask your attacker to please stop killing you. They're not going to stop killing you. And this merger of the American and Israeli militaries will be the death knell to our sovereignty once and for all. It's barely hanging on by a thread at this point, and these are the scissors to snip that thread. Let's watch this video. This is from the Leia Files, I believe, L-E-A-H on X, talking about how this new bill combining the U.S. and Israeli militaries is probably why all of the Israeli talking heads have been saying, well, we want to separate. We don't want to be dependent on America anymore. It's because they're setting this up. Let's watch.
Our government just tried to merge our military with our greatest ally's military, sneak it into a 1,000-page defense bill, and hope that nobody would notice. I read it, I analyzed it, and I want to tell you what it is, what it isn't, and what we can do. Every year, Congress has this must-pass, must-fund bill. It's the National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA. It's 1,000 pages long. Nobody reads the whole thing. Like, they don't even know what these bills say, which is very concerning. What they did was sneak into it in Section 224 with a fancy name, the United States Israel Defense Cooperation Initiative. It's boring on purpose. When the government tries to make something boring, when they try to bury it in the headlines, whoop, spidey senses go off, and we're going to pay extra close attention to it. And I'm glad I did, because this thing is wild. What it would do is link the U.S. and Israel militaries together at the deepest level that we have done with anybody. We have our Five Eyes partners. We have our partners that we are protecting. This is different. It's joint weapons development. shared military networks, something that they literally call data fusion. And if you know what data fusion is, it's basically what these data centers are that we're building. They're data fusion centers. They're pulling all of the data together. They're not just standalone stovepipe data centers. It basically means that our military's data becomes their military's data. We co-produce weapons together. And the part that not enough people are talking about is that there's one person in the Pentagon overseeing it. And if I had to put money on it, I would think it would be Feinberg. If you know what I think of Feinberg, it's really, really scary. I've done a deep dive on him. You should go check it out. But they're standing up a separate office with a separate budget. That means that it's basically impossible to undo. That is a very important point in this. Let's talk about the problems with it. Right now, we support our greatest ally through aid, hundreds, billions of dollars of aid. And we can see it. We can see who votes on it. We can see how much they send. Congress does it. And it is out in the open for us to see, make decisions on, vote people out over. But Section 224 takes that money away from being out in the open and puts it in a defense budget that is easily moved through different channels. Trust me. Back rooms of defense contracting is where this will lie. And that, to me, as a money person, says the most of what they're trying to do. Interestingly, Americans are saying no more AIPAC, no more sending money to them. And so they're like, oh, well, let's just stand up an office and call it this. Do they think we're that stupid? There would be almost no public oversight, and the DOD can't even pass an audit. So we'd actually be doing more with them and giving more to them without any of us knowing what. That's scary. Especially knowing why I think they're doing this, like their motivations for this, which is all of a sudden a public, hey, we don't want this. Oh, well, then we're going to move it to back channels. This is how we do it. With a country who actually causes more problems than anyone else. And here's the kicker. We don't even do this with our closest treaty allies. When I first saw this, the first thing I thought was, one, what is this? And two, who do we do this with? Because I've never heard of this. And I've spent 20 years in the intel community and for the DOD, unheard of. And so I was like, well, let me check. Maybe we do it somewhere. No, we don't. We don't. We don't do it with the UK. We don't do it with Canada. We don't do it with the countries that we are legally bound to defend. But we want to do it with this one? Red flags. We have no formal defense treaty with our greatest ally. This right here, the financial part, the oversight part, the moving of the money part to these dark back channels, and the fact that the two congressmen who brought this forward, which I'll have to get to in a different one, are all funded by defense contractors and AIPAC. This isn't a small detail in all of this. So let's talk about the ugly, because that wasn't ugly enough. That was just the bad. Two main things jumped out at me that are like, oof. One, it's nearly impossible to undo. An aid package expires. You can let it lapse. You can renegotiate it. It runs out. We can say no. Once you've merged networks and data and weapon systems, you can't just say, no, I don't want to do that anymore. That's infiltration. It's baked into the system permanently. The other one is that this is moving forward right now. This is moving right now. While we are in the Situation Room negotiating this war, and our greatest ally is over here out of Lebanon wanting to take 70% of Gaza, we will be merging with them. No, this is so scary. We know you're up to something nefarious when you're hiding it, when you're burying it in the headlines, when it's happening at the same time as Pam Bondi being on the AI board, as our weapons-grade plutonium going to five private companies, as Peter Thiel moving his family to Argentina, as being in the middle of a war that we can't afford, caused by our greatest ally, and now this. But they're hiding it because permanently fusing our military with our greatest allies' military, especially with the state of the United States and Americans against what they're doing, against our greatest ally, well, putting that up for a vote, they know how we'd vote. Same reason why the shady people in Congress tried to pass the FISA 702 warrantless act at 2:00 in the morning. If Americans don't want it, well, we're just not going to tell them about it. And this was their strategy because they don't think we're paying attention. And I don't think they realize the distrust that exists in America right now. Oh, we're paying attention, baby. This is treason, if you ask me. It is about Should the most permanent military entanglement in history exist? Should the greatest power, the United States, merge with anybody? No. No, absolutely not. We have had allies who have become our enemies. We don't have good pickers. It's just like regime changes. We're about to get in bed with a real toxic mofo. What do we have, Stockholm Syndrome? So here's what we can do. It's not law yet, so call your congressman. I know you say it doesn't do anything, but call them and make sure they know this is BS and you don't want it. All of them are up for re-election, so we have to at least try. Call them. It takes 60 seconds. Stay tuned.
So, you know, just a... there from the Leia files on X. I think I'm gonna expand the coverage out a little bit. I think I'm going to cover something in the next segment that I've been carrying around for weeks. I've been carrying it around for weeks, building up the courage to cover it. I think I just received a sign. I think it's time. I think it's time we talked about it. I think it's time we unveiled it. But don't think it's a coincidence that AI is merging with the military the very same time that Israel is merging with our military and Donald Trump is going to China specifically to talk about AI and the military, and he takes a whole bunch of corporate leaders here in America along with him. Yeah, we cannot allow this to pass. This cannot pass. Stay tuned, folks. I think it's going to be a big next segment. I think it's going to be crazy. Share the link. I have to admit, I'm genuinely nervous about the topic I'm about to cover. Like, I'm actually kind of shaking a little bit. But I feel like I have to, and I feel like I've kind of received a sign that I should do this. And I got to start with a little bit of a mea culpa, of an admission that I was wrong for a while. Because, and it's sort of similar to what I've said before about 1984, that when I read 1984 in high school, I didn't like it because I didn't think it was believable. I thought it was too far. I thought it was, you know, it's kind of absurd. Like, sure, people are dumb, but they're not going to do the stuff that this book, you know, represents. You get a little older and you go, well, nope, yep, people are that dumb. They are that crazy. 1984 wasn't actually that absurd. It was actually fairly accurate. And I have sort of a similar relationship with this piece of literature, in that I read it years ago and thought it was too absurd, thought it was too ridiculous, thought that the absurdity of it, you know, made it not worth talking about or covering. It was clearly a hoax, I think. But in light of certain situations that have developed over the last 2 years, I decided to revisit it. And just like 1984, I've decided this isn't actually absurd. Actually, this makes a lot of sense now, now that I'm looking at it again with fresh eyes. And I actually really started looking into this because of the Eighth Front War. So I did the Eighth Front War little mini documentary. It's gotten over 20 million views at this point. And, you know, I said that if it got to 20 million, then I would do a sequel. So I started working on the sequel to the Eighth Front War. And I thought I would do some research into it. And actually, I had my sister was just telling me a story about basically she has a friend that realized that I was her brother and, you know, was turned out to be a big fan, which is always very fun to see. My sister's telling me, she's like, yeah, he recognized your name. And there was that moment where it's like, wait, that Harrison Smith? And you're like, yes. And they're like, that guy. And what he said was, what he said was that the Eighth Front War, that this video single-handedly changed the Overton window. And not to be too prideful, but I think it has. I think it has. I think that its impact has been incredibly gratifying and perhaps has given me the confidence to do what I'm about to do now. Because if I could change the conversation once, I think I should do it again. So to do the follow-up to the Eighth Front War, I started looking at a little document you may be familiar with. It's called The Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. I can hear the crew gasping from the other side. Interestingly, this document has been around for well over 100 years. And yet, I don't understand how it could have been written before the last 2 years, since it seems to so perfectly align with everything going on. Now, to actually talk about this, because this has been probably the most maligned, I mean, the FBI will launch investigations over people owning this book. Now, it took me a long time to find this copy. This is, I believe, to be an accurate translation. There are a lot of inaccurate translations out there. It supposedly was written in 1886 or so. Of course, Henry Ford published it, and it's, you know, got very famous for that. Interestingly enough, the person who officially declared it a hoax and debunked it, Alan Dulles. Alan Dulles, before he founded the CIA, was actually the reason that people believed Protocols of the Elders of Zion to be a hoax. Now, in reality, it is a political document, and it is very, very similar in a lot of ways to Machiavelli's The Prince. But it has a different starting point in terms of human behavior, human activity. The Prince, it sort of takes the viewpoint that, like, humans are good and that you have to kind of purposefully be not good to be a good ruler. And that it's sort of teaching the Prince, like, it's okay to be bad because at the end of the day you're being good because people are dumb and can be tricked by bad people, and it's for you to protect them. It has a different starting point, but in a lot of ways, it's very similar political manifesto, and that is how this should be viewed. And also, in the protocols, it is not about a Jewish conspiracy of all Jews, and they actually use the snake as the symbol of themselves. This is one of the things that I go, okay, who is going to go, our symbol is the snake, the wily snake that represents us? It's like, really, who would take that unto themselves? One of the things I was like, okay, sure. This is a hoax. It's a hoax. It was somebody calling Jews snakes, but they wanted to make it sound like Jews were calling themselves snakes. Not very sophisticated. But in reality, what it's saying is that the Elders of Zion, the top of this organization, are the head of the snake, and that the Jews are the body of the snake. So they don't know what the head is doing, where it's going, where it's leading them, but they will follow. And that's laid out in these protocols. And again, once I read it, I think you'll, I like, just asking you to give me a second here. Let me read through some of these, and you tell me if you think this is a worthy for discussion in the modern political atmosphere. And again, it sounds absurd. It sounds ridiculous. The way this is written, it sounds like a hoax. It does. I admit that. You tell me if it's wrong. Protocol number one. And supposedly this was the notes of a meeting that took place in the late 1880s, which is another interesting thing to consider, because they talk here about the upcoming communist revolution that they're planning. Now, if the date is accurate, that means they were literally, you know, plotting the communist revolution 20 years before it actually happened. So I don't even know if this is real or not. If this is a hoax, it's one of the most sophisticated and well-informed hoaxes of all time. Protocol number one, it says, putting aside fine phrases, we shall speak of the significance of each thought. By comparisons and destructions, we shall throw light upon surrounding facts. What I am about to set forth, then, is our system from the two points of view, that of ourselves and that of the Goyim, i.e. non-Jews. So again, this is one of the things where when you see Jeff Epstein talking to all of his buddies as, you know, the trillionaires that own all wealth, and they're casually dropping the word Goyim, and they're casually referring to the fact that Jews make our money by exploiting the Goyim, and these are discussions that they're having in private communications with each other without any caveats, without any, you know, I know you don't like how I talk like this, but, you know, I'm just going to say this anyway. And trust me, I communicate with a lot of racists. Even the most racist people in the world tend to not just be racist with people they don't know if they're not, you know, think you're on the same page too. So the fact that Jeffrey Epstein and his buddies are emailing each other with open disdain for non-Jews, it's like this is just part of their regular – it's part of their understanding that they all believe in. They don't have to preface it. They don't have to test the waters first. They just know. They know they're all on the same page. So again, because of the developments over the last 2 years from the Epstein list – to the war in Iran, things that I previously would have considered ridiculous absurdities instead tend to bear a tinge of truth. And I can't help but want to look more into it. It says, it must be noted that men with bad instincts are more in number than the good, and therefore the best results in governing them are attained by violence and terror. And this is, in a lot of ways, sort of the you know, hypothesis of the entire discussion. They say the best results in governing people are attained by violence and terrorism and not by academic discussions. Every man aims at power. Everyone would like to become a dictator if only he could, and rare indeed are the men who would be willing to sacrifice the welfare of all for the sake of securing their own welfare. Again, we can get into the underlying philosophy here. I tend not to believe that's true. I tend to look around at my friends and family and neighbor and think these people are great. And these people, even if it could benefit them, they wouldn't hurt another person. But that's the mindset at work with these people, is they believe all human beings are just evil, fallen, vicious, envious, and will hurt and destroy you if they can benefit in any way. Because that's their mindset. They project that on everybody else. And they operate off of that. And it comes with disdain and condescension on top of, you know, general hatred. Here's another sort of main theory of this tome. Political freedom is an idea, but not a fact. This idea, one must know how to apply whenever it appears necessary with this bait of an idea to attract the masses of the people to one's party for the purpose of crushing another who is in authority. This task is rendered easier if the opponent has himself been infected with the idea of freedom, so-called liberalism, and for the sake of an idea is willing to yield some of his power. It is precisely here that the triumph of our theory appears. The slackened reins of government are immediately, by the law of life, caught up and gathered together by a new hand, because the blind might of the nation cannot for a single day exist without guidance, and the new authority merely fits into the place of the old, already weakened by liberalism. In our day, the power which has replaced that of the rulers who were liberal is the power of gold. There was a time when faith ruled. The idea of freedom is impossible of realization because no one knows how to use it with moderation. It is enough to hand over a people to self-government for a certain length of time for that people to be turned into a disorganized mob. From that moment on, we get internecine strife, which soon develops into battles between classes, in the midst of which states burn down and their importance is reduced to that of a heap of ashes. Whether a state exhausts itself in its own convolutions, whether its internal discord brings it under the power of external foes. In any case, it can be accounted irretrievably lost. It is in our power. The despotism of capital, which is entirely in our hands, reaches out to a straw to the state, who must take hold of it. If not, it goes to the bottom. Okay, so do you understand what it's laying out? It's saying if you basically tell the people that they have rights that the government is taking from them, then they will entreat the government to lessen its grip and, you know, be more liberal with them. If the government does that, loosens the reins, as it puts it, the natural, you know, law of power essentially is that power, like nature, abhors a vacuum and somebody else will come in to, you know, fill it up. And essentially through this process of, you know, making demands, overthrowing the ruling party, putting a new one in, repeat, you know, rinse and repeat, you reduce a state to the point that it can't sustain itself any longer. And they have to, in order to just continue operations, borrow money. Who are they going to borrow money from? The people that have attained the money in their hands in a monopolistic fashion and who did this over the course of several centuries, the Rothschild family, of course, being the preeminent example. This is the again, central part of this, and it's repeated over and over. Right is might. Our right lies in force. The word right is an abstract thought and proved by nothing. The word means no more than give me what I want in order that I thereby may have proof that I'm stronger than you. The word power means no more than give me what I want in order that I thereby prove that I'm more strong than you. I'm stronger than you. So again, when I see people, you know, today, you know, Israel is basically carpet bombing Lebanon and have actually come out with a strategy in which they are saying every one drone that Hezbollah hits us with, we're going to destroy 10 civilian buildings. We're going to, you know, murder 100 people for every drone that goes towards us. And people are, you know, pointing that and going, you know, why is nobody standing up this? Why is nobody stopping Israel? Why are they allowed to get away with this? Because they have the power. Because they have the power. They can do what they want because they're stronger than you. Might makes right. That's the philosophy that we're seeing at play here. And then point number 15 from the first protocol. This is the one that I think we're living through right now. This is the one that's been rattling around in my brain for weeks as I see the unmasking occur. It says, our power in the present tottering condition of all forms of power will be more invincible than any other because it will remain invisible until the moment when it has gained such strength that no cunning can any longer undermine it. So when you look around and you go, why is Israel being like this? Why is AIPAC being like this? Why is the ADL being like this? Why are they going so mask off? Why is the ADL going out and going, we're not here to stop defamation of everybody. We're here to support the Jews. And why is Israel coming out and basically saying, we don't care, you know, what Americans want. If you oppose us, we will oust your congressman, replace him with somebody who does support us, and you'll learn your lesson that way. I feel like they feel like their strength has now been reached, or as they put it, I think they feel as though they have, quote, gained such strength that no cunning can any longer undermine it, and so it's no longer remaining invisible. So again, this is, you know, maybe the protocols are fake. Maybe they're a hoax. It's pretty shocking that they were able to, you know, sort of predict stuff like this all the way back in the early 19, late 1800s. That's pretty amazing. But does it not reflect what's going on right now? Is it, do you not feel like this is what we're going through? That for the last several decades, slowly but surely, the power has built up behind the scenes, the globalist power, the Rothschild, Rockefeller power. And again, you read these, it's not just, it's not all the Jews and it's not just the Jews, right? They basically say, you know, we elders of Zion, the top Jews, they'll be in charge. They'll get what they want because the body of the snake, the regular Jews will follow them and listen to them and obey them. And that they'll need, by necessity of just the way the world works, their own agents, non-Jewish agents who are going to help them, will never quite rise to the point of the elders of Zion, but are necessary, a necessary component in, you know, carrying out this operation. And again, it elucidates all this. It lays it out. I just need to read because there's so much. I mean, it's, do you want to see this? Do you want to see how much I've highlighted? You want to see how much I've highlighted in this dang tome, in this book? I mean, the whole thing is worth looking at. It's all fascinating. So let's keep reading. Out of the temporary evil we are now compelled to commit will emerge the good of unshakable rule, which will restore the regular course of the machinery of the national life brought to naught by liberalism. The results justify the means. So, I mean, how many people defending the actions of Israel basically quoted that? Look, sure, what we're doing is evil, but out of the evil that we are now compelled to commit, I mean, we're not choosing to do this. We're being compelled to commit this violence. Really, we're the victims. Do you know what they're making us do to them? That's what they say. Out of the temporary evil we are now compelled to commit will emerge the good of an unshakable rule, which will restore the regular course of the machinery of national life brought to naught by liberalism. The results justify the means. And this is an interesting thing. They say the blind cannot lead the blind without bringing them into the abyss, which I'm pretty sure is a quote from the New Testament. But we'll leave that to the side. Consequently, members of the mob, upstarts from the people, even though they should be as a genius for wisdom, yet having no understanding of the political, cannot come forward as leaders of the mob without bringing the whole nation to ruin. So again, this goes back to the idea that just like regular people, if they haven't been instructed in the esoteric occult methods of controlling crowds and running, you know, political machines, then no matter how smart they are, no matter what a big genius they are, they'll fail to be a good ruler because they haven't been instructed in the methods of, as they put it, force and make-believe. Force and make-believe is their calling card. Force and make-believe. That is the way you rule the world. They say only one trained from childhood for independent rule can have understanding of the words that can be made up of the political alphabet. So this is another thing that you see cropping up over and over, as I pointed to many times, not because I was inspired by the protocols of Zion, but because you see it in evidence all around us. which is interesting because then you go read the Protocols of Zion, you go, oh, that explains it. Oh, this makes sense. I've explained it before, again, from my own observations, as a sort of casual nobility, a sort of nobility or aristocracy with a with component of, I'm blanking on merit, like a merit-based aristocracy where you aren't guaranteed necessarily to inherit the power from your father, but it will be one of the children of the main families that will be appointed to this position, and they're all sort of competing to figure out which one of them it is. But it's going to one of them. You know, who's running CBS News? Larry Ellison's son. Who's running digital ID for the UK? Tony Blair's son. Who's running the Soros Foundation? George Soros' son. They've been trained from birth to assume these positions. Anthony Blinken, former Secretary of State for the United States. His stepfather was Jeffrey Epstein's lawyer. It's a family affair. It's a family business. And they're raised with these ideas. And then you've got lines like this. This is one of the things where, again, you read it. When I first read it, and I just thought, okay, it's a hoax. It's got to be a hoax. Who would say stuff like this? Quote, we are despots. Who would just come out and say, we are despots? You know, what does that mean? But then you look at their actions, and suddenly the reasoning becomes clear. It is only with a despotic ruler that plans can be elaborated extensively and clearly in such a way to distribute the whole properly among the several parts of the machinery of the state. And again, this is why, you know, when people look at, like, why is Bibi Netanyahu allowed to do all of this? I'm pretty sure Bibi Netanyahu is their king. I don't know exactly, but reading this document, I'm like, okay, Bibi Netanyahu, they talk about this king. We're going to have a king, and everybody has to listen to him, and he has to be a despot, and we have to listen, and, you know, he's the king. I'm pretty sure Bibi Netanyahu is king of the Jews at this moment. At least that's how they act. So they go on where they, you know, dismiss and talk about the methods in which they will weaken the goyim. Behold the alcoholic animals bemused with drink, the right to an immoderate use of which comes along with freedom. It is not for us and ours to walk that road. The peoples of the goyim are bemused with alcoholic liquors. Their youth has grown stupid on classicism and from early immorality, into which it has been inducted by our special agents, by tutors, lackeys, governesses in the houses of the wealthy, by clerks and others, by our women in the places of dissipation frequented by the goyim. Goes on to say, our countersign is force and make-believe. Only force conquers in political affairs, especially if it is to be concealed in the talents essential to a statement. Violence must be the principle, and cunning and make-believe the rule for governments which do not want to lay down their crowns at the feet of agents of some new power. This evil is the one and only means to attain the end, the good. Therefore, we must not stop at bribery, deceit, and treachery when they serve towards the attainment of our ends. Our state, marching along the path of peaceful conquest, has the right to replace the horrors of war by less noticeable and more satisfactory sentences of death necessary to maintain the terror which tends to produce blind submission. Just but merciless severity is the greatest factor of strength in the state. Therefore, it is not so much by the means themselves as to the doctrine of severity that we shall triumph and bring all governments into subjection to our super government. It is enough for them to know that we are too merciless for all disobedience to cease. We shall end liberty. Do you understand what they're saying? They're saying the terror is the point. The illogic is the point, right? Thomas Massie is not an anti-Semite. Thomas Massie doesn't even hate Israel. Thomas Massie hasn't said anything that's offensive about Israel or threatened them in any way. Yet by merely opposing Israel, like he opposes every country trying to get foreign aid, by merely not playing along, they've shown that they're willing to spend tens of millions of dollars to end his career. That's the doctrine of severity. That's an investment so that they don't have to do it over and over again. You do it with a merciless, ruthless, an obsessive energy to one person and everybody else learns their lesson. That's what they're saying there. It is not so much by the means themselves as by the doctrine of severity that we shall triumph and bring all governments into subjection to our super government. It is enough for them to know that we are too merciless for disobedience to cease. Oh, you want to resist us in Lebanon? Well, we'll bomb entire cities. oh, some of you wanted to, you know, start a problem with Israel. Well, the rest of you are going to be starved to death, and then we're going to shoot you when you try to get the food that we're providing. It's a doctrine of severity. The purpose is the terror. So we'll move on from this, but we are not even all the way through Protocol 1, and there's about 25 protocols. So if y'all like this, if I should cover this more, if I'm not killed by Israel tonight for exposing this, because this continues to be the most dangerous document in the American language right now, share the link. Share these clips. If this gets a lot of, you know, support and views and stuff, I'll do it again. I'll go through this. I'll spend, a segment a day on this, going through the whole thing, if that's what y'all want. In the meantime, go read it yourself. It's the Eighth Front War. It's the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. It's the Fifth Column. It's being unveiled because they think they're too strong to be stopped.
Tina, tell us what's it like to be finally a free woman?
You know, Steve, I'm not even sure yet. After 606 days in prison, it's been quite the ordeal. But I really want to thank God for His faithfulness and getting me through it. And you know, it's been, I think probably for me, Steve, to impress upon every person out there how hard it is to lose your liberty, how easy it is to lose your liberty, but how hard it is to endure it. And, I'm so grateful to the supporters out there that have stood with me. My close circle, Marcy, my best friend, who I called every day. After they kept putting me in the hole, she made me promise to call her in the morning and at night every day. So people that wanted to get me a message could always reach her. And of course, with Apollo and Jared and Barbara and, the other ones that have stood by me, and especially my attorneys. John Case has visited me almost every week while I was in prison. And then the financial support, I still have a fight to go. I still, even though Governor Polis reduced my sentence from 9 years to 4.5 years, I still have a fight to clear my name and bring out the truth of why they came after me the way they did. So it's still a long road. I'm going to spend the next few weeks regaining my health and just being in with loved ones and family, and it's a miracle. It really is for Jared Polis. He pardoned 35 people and he gave clemency to 9, and I was one of the 9. And you see the horrible media and the haters that go after, that don't go after, murderers and people like that, he chose to pardon, but they go after me. So there is a concern there for, my well-being and my safety. I'm just very, very grateful. Very grateful to all of you. Thank you, Steve, for standing through with me through all of this.
So just incredible stuff. Thank goodness Tina Peters is free. And again, there's something about these people that are politically persecuted that they just maintain, like, because they're innocent, I guess, which I don't know. To me, it seems like knowing that you're innocent, being sent to jail, you would expect just mentally to like crumble because it's so painful. But whether it's Tina Peters or Stuart Rhodes or any of them, they go to jail. They're being confronted with the most oppressive, tyrannical things that the American government has ever done to anybody. And yet they're like happy. They're like joyful. They're like, they know that what they're doing is right and that the price they're paying is worth it. And it's really incredibly admirable. And I guess we can tack that on to the things Trump has done well. So we're up to a count of 2 now. We have I'm joking, of course. He's done more than two things, but I continue to say that the only like unimpeachable, no pun intended, but the like pure good that he's done is by pardoning the January Sixers and now getting Tina Peters free, even though it wasn't him. He apparently had some hand in it. Former county clerk of Mesa County, Colorado, Tina Peters has been released from jail Monday after being imprisoned under the Biden administration rule in 2022 for allegedly trying to help President Trump, quote, overturn the election. Has been quite the ordeal, quite a example of injustice. And I would hope that this is honestly just the beginning of Tina Peters' story. I hope she sues them to hell. I hope she bankrupts the people that did this to us, to her, because she didn't deserve it. What would happen to a regular person if they kidnapped Tina Peters? Because they kidnapped Tina Peters. Didn't matter if they did it with a badge on. It was illegal. We're going to get back to the Middle East war, Iran, Israel, all that stuff in the next segment. We're going to be breaking down exactly what has occurred over the last weekend, the ceasefire conundrum that we find ourselves in. We'll be joined by Lebanon John, who's going to lay out for us sort of the underlying currents that are driving the... Did Rob pay you to do that? Rob's out here undercutting me. Rob Dew. They show my nameplate and they show Rob Dew's name underneath. I'm on to y'all. I get it. I understand. Kidding, of course. There's nothing the crew loves more than when you point out and highlight their very minor mistakes that they rarely don't make that often. But I see them, but I notice them. Folks, this is the hardest working crew in the business. Now that I've mocked them slightly, let me now praise them unironically, because this is the best crew in the business. And when problems arise, do you see how fast they correct them? Do you see the type of institutional flexibility we have here because of this multi-talented crew that we have operating behind the scenes? And again, I'm not even saying this ironically. I mean, this is totally unironic. We do have the best crew. They do work incredibly hard. When you watch this show, you see Alex sitting behind the desk, or you see me sitting behind the desk. You see the graphics and stuff, but you know it's TV magic. There's literally a Willy Wonka, you know, Oompa Loompa factory just on the other side of that wall, with the minions doing their thing and keeping us afloat. So, you know, everything that you see here is propped up. It's like that cartoon, the meme of all the soldiers holding up the world as we know it. You know, this beautiful little slice of paradise we have is kept up by the grisly grinding, you know, sausage making in the factory just on the other side of that wall. And but seriously, it takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of talent and elbow grease and long nights and, you know, overtime hours to keep this organization running as smoothly as it does, to fighting back against all the attacks that we're under, getting the videos out, and making sure that we fulfill our end of the bargain that we have with you. And I hope that you can support us in this mission, because it's not just me, it's not just Alex, it is this whole crew, it is this entire operation, it is this heart of the resistance that you're supporting by going to thealexjonesstore.com. We make it incredibly easy for you to support us. We have fantastic products that absolutely everybody needs. Again, unless you are Adonis, unless you are a demigod, you probably have some sort of lack of something or other that would greatly improve your life if you could mitigate it. And you don't know whether it's iodine or, I mean, people don't know. You got to go. You got to try this stuff. And I guarantee that you will appreciate the effects. And you'll miss the effects when they go away. Shilajit, Iris CMOS, ultramethylene red, ultramethylene blue, colostrum. All of this stuff is top of the line. All of it is incredible. The crew takes all of it. You want to know how our crew is so incredible? Because they're all hopped up on our supplements at thealexjonesstore.com. We have it in our, you know, pantry at home too. We don't tell you things we don't believe. We don't sell you things we don't use. And we certainly don't sell you things that are ineffective or tell you things that are false. And I hope that you can support us in this mission by purchasing one of these products, spreading the links, spreading the word, getting hopped up yourself, folks. And again, I do hope you appreciate. I mean, I'm just saying, I mean, things have changed a lot recently. I don't know if they've changed enough to retain your credibility and talk about the protocols of Elders of Zion. I may have just totally torched my credibility for the foreseeable future. But I think if people read it, though, I think they'll get where I'm coming from. I think actually the more you read, the more sense it makes. We only got halfway through the first protocol. There's like 20 in there. They get into everything. I mean, they get into how it all works, and you can see it. And we'll go through it. We'll talk about it more, but you got to support us. You got to support us. We aren't putting our lives at risk for nothing here. We're doing it because we're trying to save the world. And the only way we can do that is if we have your support to broadcast this message, because I guarantee you nobody else, no other network is going to be talking about the protocols of the Elders of Zion. That's for damn sure. We have a lot of other news to get into, though, and we will return to the Mideast in the next segment as we go over what the latest with the ceasefire is. In the meantime, I once again have another slightly longer video to go to. Again, I think it's worth it. This is clip number two. This is the leader of Restore Britain, the up-and-coming nationalistic Britain First. What would it be? MABA movement? Make America Britain again? No, that's not right. Wait, no, that's completely wrong. It'd be MBGA, or something. Make Britain great again. Yeah, MBGA. I really shouldn't even be joking about this. I am excited about Restore Britain. I do think that they, for once, actually seem like a political party that understands the gravity of the situation and has policies to deal with it. As much as we like Nigel Farage and Brexit, they've just been utterly disappointing when it comes to things like the demographic replacement of the British people by foreigners. And Restore Britain is actually, you know, very much championing that cause. And they've also been just desperately fighting to get information released about the grooming gang scandal. And this has been resisted at every level of the British government from every other party because they know just how bad it looks. And this is, again, I think perhaps, you know, an outgrowth of everything else going on in the world. But the leader of Restore UK came out and said, he basically compared what happened to British girls at the hands of migrants. He equated it to the Holocaust. And people, of course, got mad at this because you're not supposed to equate anything with the Holocaust. The Holocaust stands alone and above every other conflict, every other example of genocide, every other example of anything like that that you want to talk about. You're never allowed to compare the Holocaust to that, whatever it is. But he did. He did, and then they demanded an apology, and he said, I'm not apologizing, because that is the gravity of the situation that we're dealing with. That is the reality of what has been done to British girls. It has been a Holocaust. It has been a form of genocide. And it has not only been allowed to occur under iterative UK governments. It has been facilitated and actually made to happen because of those governments. And, you know, I guess I'll find his response on the other side, because I did think that the way that he responded to the demand that he apologized for daring to be as concerned with his own people as he is with the plight of the Jews. Yeah, this is at Rupert Lowe, MP, on X. So he was asked to apologize for comparing the plight of little English girls to what happened to Jews under Nazi Germany. And he said, I want to be really clear in my response. I'm not going to retract anything. I stand by every single word. Labor are calling for me to apologize. The answer is no. Industrial rape across every town and city in Britain. Sexual torture, murder, endless rape. I sat there for 2 weeks listening to these girls. I heard how one girl was raped by a dog, as Muslim men bet on what the animal would do. Girls drugged and locked in cages like rats. Another raped by 700 men over 3 years. Dozens and dozens of these stories through our inquiry, and we are barely scratching the surface. This was allowed to happen exactly because politicians were cowards, refusing to discuss it. I will not make that same mistake. I said what I said, and I meant it. The Labour Party have blood on their hands, yet they think they can demand an apology from me for highlighting the systemic evil that they've allowed to infect our entire country. They can piss off. I'm angry about it. Furious. When you hear directly from these girls about what they've been through, it changes the way you see politics forever. Our report will be out very soon. When that happens, I don't want any apologies from the Labor Party. I don't care about that. I want to see these politicians responsible for covering up this atrocity behind bars for what they've done to these girls. And while I thoroughly applaud everything that he's saying, behind bars, buddy, I guess what, he's a politician. I want to see them tortured to death, but no, behind bars is a good middle ground, I think. Looper Rowe calls grooming gang scandal something the equivalent of the Holocaust. The Restore Britain leader has been criticized by Jewish groups for the deeply offensive remark. And I'll tell you, to me, what's deeply offensive is the fact that they don't care. They don't care. This was Nick Fuentes' response when he was on with Piers Morgan and they brought on that guy to say, me mom died in the holly. And, you know, Nick's response afterwards was, why, like, you're so offended, you want me to bow and scrape and apologize for not caring about your people. You don't care about my people. You expect me to care about something that happened to your great-grandmother, but you don't care about what's happening to me right now. And in a lot of cases, you're the one doing it. So, like, what is this? What is this inequality of care that we're supposed to endlessly feel guilty about something we stopped, the Holocaust? We're supposed to uphold that singular historical event over and above literally any other event, even ones that are worse. I mean, hell, the number of Christians killed under the Bolsheviks was like 10 times the number of Jews that died in the Holocaust, the official numbers. What Israel is doing right now as we speak is worse than the Holocaust. That's my position, has been for a while. So, like, the idea that the labor MPs or whoever it is, they didn't care enough about what was happening to you, to the UK girls, to do anything to stop it. But you're not allowed to compare it to the Holocaust. So again, the offense should really be felt by the British, by these people who demand that you bow and scrape over their historical trauma while simultaneously downplaying, if not outright, you know, enjoying the genocide going on against the UK people as we speak. That's despicable, but not exactly surprising. Here's Rupert Lowe in Parliament, clip number two, talking about what he heard during the rape gang inquiry. Let's watch.
Firstly, I would like to thank the 260,974 British men and women who signed the petition to make this debate possible. And I want to welcome these brave survivors who are sitting behind us in the hall. This debate is about them. As you quite rightly say, it's not about politics. I want the world to hear what we heard during the 2 weeks of our independent rape gang inquiry hearings, an inquiry that should never have needed to happen. I sincerely urge this Parliament to listen to the testimonies from these brave survivors and to act, to finally act. So the first testimony, he took his pants down, penetrated me, had sex with me. He then stopped before ejaculation. He picked up the bottle of Jack Daniels, which was now empty, and he forced it up inside me. He broke the glass while he was there. At that point, I was about 12, nearly 13. Another testimony. I was held down by the men as they each took turns to orally and vaginally rape me, taking it in turns to pin down my arms and my legs. When the assault ended, the men hit me repeatedly, threatened to find me, kill me, and harmed my loved ones if I ever told anybody what had happened. Another. Comments were constantly made suggesting that white girls, the Christian girls, were viewed as having fewer morals or lower values, whereas Muslim girls were described by some of the men as having dignity and higher moral standing. These comparisons were used to justify the way I was treated and to further humiliate and control me. Another. She was a white woman herself, who I imagine may have been groomed, and has obviously now married into the family, shouting obscenities at us. Throughout the whole sentencing, she was constantly saying, liars, lying white bitches. She said to me that God will be the witness for what happens to me. Another. Race did play a part and motivated the selection or demographic of the victims. Throughout my exploitation, the other girls I encountered or who were abused alongside me were almost exclusively white. Another. She had a baby by him, and his dad was an imam. His dad knew. And he got his son married and said that he wasn't allowed to see the child. They look after their own community. Another. Over the course of the abuse, I was raped by multiple police officers in different parts of the country. Another. He put a cigarette out on the baby's face. Another. It started when I was 13. I was raped by probably about 600 or 700 different men over 3 years. Another. They would toot the horn of the car, and then a child would be taken to the front door by a staff member of the children's home. Another. I was bleeding from both my vagina and my back passage and was so swollen I could not sit down. I told hospital staff my drink had been spiked and I did not know what had happened because I was too afraid to tell the truth. They did not ask any questions. They gave me tablets and discharged me. I was 15 years old. Another. Things would escalate around Eid and holidays. Parties got bigger, got worse, got more violent. People, more people involved, more girls involved. The parties were just bigger. Another. The main clash that I kind of had with the religion side of it was I grew up as a Christian. I would wear my cross because it was something really special to me. It was just used as a way to break me down. They said, "Where is your God now? Has your God forsaken you?" Another. It was all of the white girls in every home that I went to. I remember a man opening the back of a van, and I saw 15, 20 girls locked in dog cages. Another. Dogs were brought in, and I couldn't move at all. I had nowhere to move. I think that was the scariest thing, was not having any concept of it. There were men around me, not horrified, not disgusted, not helping, but filming and laughing, making bets on whether the dog could actually rape me or not. And yes, I was raped by a dog. The man just held my face, stared me down straight in the eyes, and he wanted to see me break, and he did. Another, I just wanted to stop and not happen to any other children and for people to actually act, to do something and stop being so scared. I could continue for hours and hours. All of us in this building have a responsibility to finally act. Not to talk, but to act. Our Rape Gang Inquiry report will be released in the coming days. It will change Britain for good. Thank you.
Yeah, horrifying stuff. I mean, what else is there to say? It's beyond words, actually. And yet the liberals in the UK are furious at Rupert Lowe for exposing this, for talking about this. If you're shocked by any of that, I mean, it's a condemnation of the entire system that everybody doesn't know this is going on. And like that, it's really what you got to think about, that this stuff was known. This stuff was well known by the people in the media whose job it is to inform people about what's going on. They hid that on purpose. We did everything we could to bring attention to this type of stuff. This is a post I did on August 6th of 2024. It's nearly 2 years ago. I said, "You probably don't realize how bad the UK grooming scandal is. You think you do, but you don't." And this was the story about a Bradford victim saying that the orphanage, the care home that they were living in, acted like a brothel. She said her abusers were men of Pakistani heritage, and care home staff would see the older men arrive and tell her, "Go out and see them." So you have little British girls that have been orphaned by one tragedy or another, who literally have nobody in the world to look after them, no family, no siblings, no parents. They're placed in the trust of the state. The state gives jobs to Muslim women who then act as the pimps to the little orphan girls who they know have no ability to fight back, who they know have no ability to speak out. And again, this is all on purpose, by design. They knew about it. They covered it up so that it could happen more. They're all complicit. And this is what happens when, you know, they go, well, all these Pakistanis are here. I guess, you know, we got to have them be part of the community. So they literally go out of their way to give jobs to the Pakistanis in state employment. So, of course, you're going to have, you know, the rapist himself, his brother is the chief of police, his sister is the woman who runs the care home. They've got it all unlocked. They've got all their positions covered. And when it eventually comes out, they have the UK population so petrified, so terrified of seeming racist that they allowed this to go on unabated for years on end. And I don't know what we need to do to snap British people out of their malaise, snap them out of their hypnotism, and let them know this is what is being done to them and they need to fight back. Because it's very, very close to being too late to fight back. This is Rupert Lowe, another response. All these relentless establishment attacks this week, very many personal attacks against me, they all underestimate our most important defense. I do not give a crap what these people think. I'm not in this to make friends in posh parts of central London. If I cared about any of that, I'd have quit politics a long time ago. I don't need the money. I don't need the status. I don't need the hassle. I care about one thing and one thing only, leaving the country in a better state than it was that was gifted to my generation. All of the endless insults and abuse mean nothing. I've had thousands and thousands of Southampton fans collectively scream that I'm a wanker when I was chairman. These jumped up little gits in London have got nothing on the Saints lads. The Labour Party, the BBC, Farage, the FT, Reform, the Guardian, the Jewish Chronicle, the Times, certain Tory MPs. I could go on and on. I just do not care what any of them think, and nor should you. You know, I disagree. I think you should care. I think you should care that there are people trying to cover this up. I think that's actually the biggest problem in all of it. I think literally anybody attacking Rupert Lowe for doing this themselves needs to be held to account for it. I mean, if you're not going to have free speech in Britain, you should use it for something. How about anybody trying to cover up the crimes exposed by Rupert Lowe is in a way responsible for those crimes? Even now, as they're trying to cover them up, you'd only cover them up so that you could continue to do them in the future. I mean, what else could you hear? What else could be said about what was done to British girls before it's realized that it was on purpose, that it was industrial, and that to this day, the people that carried it out are still in power and still trying to cover up the consequences of it. So God bless Rupert Lowe and the Restore Party of Britain. But they may be coming into trouble, though, if people like old Melanie Phillips have anything to say about it. See, they don't love Israel enough. And you can't have British sovereignty if you don't love Israel. Don't you know that? We'll be right back. Talk about the Mideast War. Stay with us. We're going to be joined shortly by Lebanon John, my co-host on Moonbase Live. He's going to break down sort of what the latest series of events between America, Israel, and Iran have, you know, what's occurred over the last couple of days. It's extremely interesting. And guys, make sure you have all the articles and tweets that he sent over as well, because we're going to lay it out like a narrative. But since we're talking about the UK and their suicidal dedication to immigration, pretty coincidental that just a few minutes ago, the body cam footage for the arrest of Henry Nowak has finally been released. If you don't know about this story, basically Henry Nowak was an 18-year-old college student who was walking home. He was murdered in Southampton, England on December 3rd, 2025. He was stabbed five times by Vikram Digwa, who used a 21-centimeter ceremonial knife while walking home from a night out. Despite Nowak telling police officers multiple times that he had been stabbed and could not breathe, they handcuffed him and treated him as a suspect after Digwa falsely claimed that Nowak had racially abused him and initiated a physical assault. And we found out some more information later on. Apparently, the knifeman's mother showed up to take the knife away before it happened. I've also heard rumors that it was perhaps a family member of the knifeman, a family member of this Digwa guy who called in and basically called 911 and said, you know, my brother was attacked by this racist white guy. So I believe that's the background of this. So we're about to watch the video. The video has been released about 3 minutes long. I have not watched it yet. So we're going to watch it live here and you know, see what actually happened, see if it was as horrifying as the transcript sounds. And I believe the context is that the police are showing up having been called by somebody who said it was the white guy who was the attacker. And I think that's the context that they were approaching in, just to maybe that'll make more sense of the way this was handled. Again, I haven't watched this, so whenever we get that video in, we'll go to it. Vikram Digwa was convicted of murder and sentenced to life imprisonment with a minimum sentence of 21 years. Digwa's mother, Kiran Kaur, was also convicted of assisting an offender after she removed the murder weapon from the scene. The Hampshire and Isle of Wight Constabulary apologized for arresting Nowak as he was dying and referred the case to an independent office for police conduct and investigation. And there's other, you know, very disturbing things that have been heard. Maybe we'll see it in this video, where apparently when the female officers arrived, they actually looked through Nowak's phone and the phone of his father to try to find evidence of them, like, saying racist jokes or something so they could arrest him for racism. This is the body cam footage from the police responding to the murder of Henry Nowak. I mean, this whole show has been parental advisory, and I assume this is too. Again, we haven't seen this. We're all watching it live here. This was released minutes ago. Here's the body cam footage of the murder of Henry Nowak.
He was on the bin on the other side of this gate.
Yeah, he's jumped over these fences and stuff like that.
And he's up here. Get away, mate. His officers. He's fallen from there and he's slipped from there.
His other shoe is left over there, mate.
What's your name, mate? Huh? Has anyone been hurt other than him?
Yeah,
he's,
me.
His grandma, brother. He's took my turban off, started grabbing my head.
Are you injured?
Yeah, I've got swollen eye, a little bruise.
So that's the murder.
Step back a little bit for me. Someone flag these down.
Oh, there's his foot. Okay, right, so he's laying on the ground.
Let's get out of there, shall
we? I was in bed asleep.
I'll grab his other arm.
So there they're grabbing his arms. He's been stabbed in the back. He has apparently a dagger cut across his face. And here they're pulling his arms behind his back to arrest him.
I don't think you have, mate.
So that was the line, I've been stabbed. He says, I don't think you have, mate.
Hand?
Put
the hand in the cuff, mate.
He's
saying he's been stabbed, so
where
let's just check him.
Where do you think he's been stabbed? In the face? Oh, no, but we have to check, don't we?
Right.
In the face?
Just get these back off, get their details on that, and I'll keep hold of them. Keep you on your side, mate. You better retrieve then.
Okay.
Saying to him, keeping him on his side. We were sat up when we had him here, but he didn't like it. What's your name, mate? By the moment, you are under arrest, and that's for assault, so you do not have to say anything. May harm in defence if you do not mention when questioned. So I'll switch you later in line of court. Anything you do say may be given in evidence, alright? It's going to be sick, I think.
He's literally dying right in front of them. He's told them that he's been stabbed. They said, I don't think you have.
What's his name?
He's literally dying in their hands right now.
Yeah, we've got this male. He's been beat up. Are we able to get an ambulance, please? His pupils aren't even reacting.
His pupils aren't reacting to light. Jesus. All right, so that's the body cam footage. Henry Nowak dying. He's literally laying on the ground, like, non-responsive when they get there. In the first, like, minute, the cop is just saying they're talking to people while the kid is lying on the ground saying, "I've been stabbed." God. Absolutely horrifying. And, of course, you heard the stabber there, like, "Oh, I got a swollen eye here." I mean, and the whole family standing around there participating with him. Completely insane. Again, I don't know, you know, I don't know what I can do to inspire the people of the UK to understand the situation that they're in if reality itself isn't a good enough teacher. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Just horrifying. Just absolutely horrifying. And with that, that very somber intro, gosh, absolutely brutal. But hey, we're going to go from one, you know, one single death is a tragedy to now hundreds of death are just a Monday afternoon in Lebanon. Now that Israel has placed the eye of Sauron on them, that's actually, maybe that's the perfect intro to this. Maybe, you know, we get to see sort of the harrowing, horrifying reality of one person dying, and now we're going to talk about thousands and thousands of innocent people being killed in an equally brutal and ruthless way. Of course, my co-host on Moonbase Live, you can follow us at Moonbase Live on Rumble, Moonbase Live. We're gonna kickstart the Wednesday night broadcast once again, starting this Wednesday. Lebanon John, you can follow him on X at Lebanon_John. He's an American of Lebanese extraction, but keeps his finger on the pulse of Middle Eastern affairs. And, John, you called me today and we're explaining the sort of timeline of what's happening in the Middle East. And I said, well, why don't you just call in and explain to everybody? Because that typically is what happens, is if I need something from the Middle East decoded, I'll ask John and I'll try to present it to the audience. If it makes sense. I don't always agree with John, but he knows more about this stuff than I do. John, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks. Man, I think that guy in that body cam footage is going to be sick.
Yeah, I think he might. His pupils aren't responding to light.
The police officer said, "I think he's going to be sick." Like, I can't believe what I just watched. That was horrible, man.
Crazy. Now, the UK, man, it's coming here if we don't do something.
Man, you would think they'd have a little experience with knife stabbings after that. You know, after how many knife stabbings happened over there, they apparently can't even figure out knife stabbings. Like, wow,
crazy,
just horrible.
Crazy. I mean, I think it also goes to show you that, like, you don't be polite in that situation. That kid should have been screaming his head off the entire time, going, "I've been stabbed, I've been stabbed, I've been stabbed." You can't just quietly expect people to know this stuff. Man, crazy stuff. But yeah, that just broke. So sorry, you know, I was expecting to go to Lebanon John right out of the gate here, but that broke. So I thought we had to go to that first, just so people can see it. But it's kind of hard. We need like a palate cleanser now. We need to like play videos of puppies for a little bit just to get our minds off it. But obviously what's happening in the Middle East is that horrifying times 1,000, because it's happening at a, you know, even more industrial scale. And I know you have a lot, you sent us a lot of content to go through. Where should we start, John?
Well, you know, just to give it context, I guess we start at the beginning as a lot of people have already heard. Donald Trump has been signaling, the White House, the U.S. administration in general, has been signaling that they are well on their way to ending the Iran war and creating a good deal for both sides. And obviously people are skeptical of that and people didn't really want to believe that. But the news that had been coming out in the last couple of days was very positive. It was reasonable agreements. They even went further than anyone ever expected and even promised a $300 billion reconstruction fund that would enable, you know, United States investment to make profit on the reconstruction of Iran, which is usually historically speaking, how wars end, and end on good terms, because it would be an influx of massive amounts of American money, potentially American companies who are now making money in rebuilding Iran. And of course, then both countries, both governments then have a vested interest in peace moving forward. So that's like a very unusual and unexpected positive development. Now, then,
well, and just back to what you said here from, from Kobasi Letter on X, the proposed U.S.-Iran peace deal includes a $300 billion reconstruction fund for Iran, per New York Times. The program is being called an international investment fund, which the U.S. would facilitate in the final deal. This comes as Iran demands reparations in the war. So that was May 29th. So what was that? Friday, I guess, right? Was that 30? Yeah.
So yeah, 2 days ago, a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
So so Iran was saying, you know, we want reparations. And then the United States, I guess, counter proposed back. Well, instead of reparations, how about an investment fund? How about, you know, we reconstruct Iran with international money? So it's not exactly free money. It's for profit. The investors will make a return. But again, it creates a financial incentive for both parties to go for peace. So generally a good thing for the world, except for those warmonger types. You know, the types.
The Mark
from,
Levin
like, Pompeo,
types, you might say.
Mark Levin, all these guys who they tried to replace MAGA. The real original MAGA crowd was basically replaced by these Israel first, you know, MIGA crowd. And then when Donald Trump says he's going to make this deal, all of a sudden they turned on Donald Trump pretty quickly and you know, leaving Donald Trump with almost no support at that point because he's disillusioned the majority of his original supporters, kowtowing and, you know, sucking up to these a bunch of never Trumpers, to be honest with you. And then now that he's, you know, seeking a reasonable end to the war, they basically are turning on him immediately, coordinated fashion.
He's very much damned if you do, damned if you don't territory, right? Because if he continues to fight the war with Iran, it's destroying the economy. People hate it. His base hates it. But he can't exactly pull out without pissing off Israel and destroying, you know, the few deep pocket supporters that he has here in America. So he's sort of screwed a little bit here.
He is. And obviously they probably have other ways to twist the screws on him, whether it be economic blackmail or actual blackmail, whether real or not, or threats of violence or all kinds of stuff at this point. I mean, you know, it's a dark situation, a tough situation where I don't think Donald Trump wants to continue the war. I think that's pretty obvious. I think that the Iranians have shown that the war is going to hurt America. And that's, you know, that's enough analysis right there. The war is bad for America. And that's, you know, you could analyze it all day, but that's kind of enough right there. And
if you're president of the United States, yeah, that should be your overriding and abiding concern. But yeah.
Right.
I think that should be it.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's how everything was looking. But then there's this little, you know, sticking point. Well, what about Lebanon? Now, if it was up to Israel and the United States, they would divorce the two fronts, the Lebanese front and the Iranian front. They would separate them and isolate them so that they could focus all their attention militarily and intelligence wise just on Lebanon, eliminate that threat theoretically. It has never actually been achieved, but theoretically. And then later on, come back and focus on Iran. In theory, that could be the plan. But again, this $300 billion investment fund is not the kind of thing you do if you're planning on kicking off this war again next week, right? So there's different parties here with different objectives. The Israeli first objective is to ultimately completely, you know, dismantle the Iranian civilization. That is obviously what there is in their interest. Is that what the actual American administration has as their plan? Probably not. Probably not. And apparently, you know, there's a difference of opinion here between the Israeli government and the United States government. And that's pretty much It started to become clear. And now what I'm about to tell you next will make it very clear, because now they're publicly saying this.
Well, and just to just clarify what you're saying, or you know, back it up from the Daily Mail, Trump's ceasefire collapses as Iran ends peace talk over Benjamin Netanyahu's fresh bombing campaign. And again, you know, this wasn't exactly hard to predict. I'm pretty sure I predicted this exact thing when they announced the ceasefire. I said, yeah, well, until, you know, Israel refuses to stop bombing Lebanon. I mean, and I'm not patting myself on the back. I'm saying it was obvious to everybody how this was going to go. How this is going to play out, and you know, Israel is playing its role of, you know, relentless warmonger, terroristic murderer of innocents. Iran has severed all diplomatic talks with the U.S., accusing Israel of violating the ceasefire by bombing its proxy militia Hezbollah in Lebanon. And that, and not to jump ahead of you, but actually I won't jump ahead of you. I'll let you lay it out, because I've got Trump's Truth Social, where apparently. He, you know, Netanyahu agreed with him and then completely betrayed him and stabbed him in the back. But yes, so, it, you know, again, it's not speculative. Iran is like, because Israel is bombing Lebanon, we are no longer talking to you. Pretty simple.
Right. So the way it played out step by step, the peace negotiations look like they're going great, better than anyone could have hoped even. Real intentionality from the United States to end this. The Israelis have occupied a large area of South Lebanon, and in the end, that just plays into the hand of the Lebanese Shiite militias there, because they can just use these first-person view drones, FPV drones, to hit these Israeli positions essentially in random moments in random places from random angles. And so the more the Israelis have occupied land and have spread out, essentially it's more easy for them to get hit. And so the Israelis are sick of that and complaining, because their government has given them no means to counter these drones. They don't have any answer. They've just spread them out all over a land that is not theirs. And therefore, it's pretty easy for them to get hit, and they're getting hit daily.
Yeah.
So it's not a good situation for them.
Yeah, and let's explain this. So the Litani River is a river inside Lebanon, and that was sort of their goal, to reach the Litani River and like sort of depopulate everything to the south of that, right, more or less. And they've essentially made it to the Litani River. They've now passed it, and this is a huge deal for Lebanon or for Israel, because I don't think they've ever gone this – well, I guess they did, because they'd been here in the 80s, but since the 80s, they'd never, you know, gotten this far into Lebanon. So they are simultaneously encroaching on Lebanon, expanding more into Lebanon, but that's making them more vulnerable to the Hezbollah drones. And Hezbollah has adopted a lot of the drone technology from the Ukraine war, things like tethers with fiber optic cables, so that there's no radio signals for Israel to intercept and disrupt. So they have no ability to stop these first-person view drones from not just destroying their tanks, destroying the Iron Dome batteries, but also they've gotten FPV drones into the command centers there, you know, in these positions. So while Israel is expanding and, you know, conquering in Lebanon, the more they do that, the more vulnerable they come to drone attack by Hezbollah.
Right. So Hezbollah, being a guerrilla warfare specialty organization, has opted for the strategy of using FPV drones and not holding one exact location. So they've basically welcomed Israel in and intentionally not put up stiff resistance, and instead are pretty much attacking from hidden positions, and Israel can't find them.
John, this is huge, and this goes right into everything that you're saying. We're coming up to the end of the segment here, but we'll hold you over, because we played that video in the beginning, and I think what you're laying out is really important. But this just dropped 5 minutes ago at 4:47 p.m. from Donald Trump. He says, I had a conversation with Bibi Netanyahu today, asking him not to go into a major raid of Beirut, Lebanon. He turned his troops around. Thank you, Bibi. I also had a conversation with representatives of the leader of Hezbollah, and they agreed to stop shooting at Israel and its soldiers. Likewise, Israel agreed to stop shooting at them. Let's see how long it lasts. Hopefully it will be for eternity, President Donald J. Trump. So that's it. So he asked Bibi Netanyahu. So yesterday he asked him not to, and Bibi said, we're launching a full force, you know, attack on Lebanon, did the complete opposite. But today, I guess he had a change of heart. What's your read on this, John, quickly? And then we'll return to the timeline here of how we got here. But this just broke minutes ago. What's your fresh take on that?
Yeah, so it's not actually about occupying Beirut with soldiers. What it's about is the Israeli government attempting to have an answer for these drones, for their troops being sitting ducks. So the answer that they came up with, that they were publicly floating, was to essentially collapse random apartment buildings to slaughter between 20 to 100 to 150 random people every single time one of their soldiers gets hit by a drone, in an attempt to create some formula of deterrence, because they can't find the Hezbollah fighters and they have no means to hurt Hezbollah other than just attacking the population itself.
Literal, just straight up terrorism. Just telling the Lebanese people, unless you stop Hezbollah from launching these drones, we're going to kill you, basically.
Yeah, but actually, of course, the Lebanese civilians in a city hundreds of miles away from the border have no means to. The Hezbollah military structure is decentralized at this point. They don't take orders from anyone. It's a bunch of individual cells operating independently. So there literally is no way that a civilian it could actually force. fighters to surrender their land. I mean, there's no way that could actually happen. They're just trying to emotionally hurt the fighters by hurting random civilians that the fighters are supposedly protecting. And so it's just like a form of terrorism and collective punishment. And so when Donald Trump says, "I told them not to do this big raid on Beirut," what he's specifically talking about is the suburbs of South Beirut called Dahiyat, which is the Hezbollah population stronghold. And so it's just a bunch of people who support Hezbollah because they are Shiite Muslim. And so Israel said we were going to just commit massacres in Dahiyat and flatten Dahiyat in order to do collective punishment because we can't counter the drones. And so when Israel said that they were going to do that, that's exactly what in specific the Iranian government said. Okay, well, now we're not even going to enter negotiations anymore. Negotiations are done. The peace talks are over. We're not even going to continue negotiating whatsoever if you guys do that. And then word on the street and rumors started to swirl that Hezbollah was preparing a very large missile salvo using missiles that they've never shown exposed before, hitting many sensitive targets in Israel, which they have refrained from hitting up until this point, combined with the Iranian large-scale attack. And I think the word of this massive attack building up, because I don't think they were willing to accept Dahiyat being flattened. And so I think that the word of this counterattack is what made Donald Trump swoop in and tell Israel to back off.
Interesting. Okay, well, we'll pick it up right there where we left off, and we'll actually pick it up with a member of the Israeli Knesset, their version of parliament, Yisrael Betanu, party chairman and former war minister Avigdor Lieberman, basically saying Dahiyat must be flattened now. We must not stop until the last building has been brought down. And of course, he looks a lot like a grapefruit. He has a body the shape of a grapefruit, which I keep seeing as a persistent theme, is that you've got a bunch of nerdy-looking twinks in Israel who feel like, you know, they're the masters of the universe and can threaten people like Hezbollah. We'll be right back with more. Welcome back, folks. Third hour of the War Room is on. I'm joined by my Moonbase Live co-host, Lebanon John, talking about the decisions being made in the Middle East and what is motivating them. Guys, we have that video. It's from The Cradle, The Cradle Media on X. Israeli MK, opposition party chairman and former war minister, Lieberman, says, quote, "It's unacceptable that northern Israel has been under heavy bombardment for days. Soldiers are being wounded and killed, and Israel's prime minister is waiting for Trump's approval to bomb Dahiyat. We are not a banana republic. Dahiyat must be flattened now, and we must not stop until the last building there has been brought down." We can go ahead and go to this video now, although I believe it's in Hebrew, but here's him saying it. These are the videos that John sent in. All right, pull those videos in and we'll go to them, but it's fine. It was in Hebrew. It was in Hebrew anyway. So that's an Israeli member of the Knesset saying, "Hey, we should deliberately disobey Trump, not listen to him, and go basically on a terror bombing campaign against this Beirut suburb because they can't figure out how to stop Hezbollah from attacking the men that they have on Lebanese soil. So let's pick it up there, John.
Yes. So all those people like whoever it is, Mark Levin and all these other guys who people have questioned, you know, whether they're America first or Israel first. Well, here's the moment. Here is the exact moment where there is a clear public disagreement, a clear difference in the two sides, right? Where if you're America first, you need to follow Donald Trump's lead on this. Or if you're Israel first, then you're going to follow Israel's lead on this. So which one is it? So you could put this exact question to every single one of these people and say, should they jeopardize the oil and gas industry of the entire world? Should they jeopardize the energy crisis of the entire world? Should they jeopardize the shipping security, both in the Strait of Hormuz and the Bab el-Mandeb in front of Yemen and in front of in the Persian Gulf, both? Because the Iranians now said that if you guys continue with this plan and you actually start flattening Dahiyeh, then they're also going to activate the Yemenis. And they said they're also going to activate the Palestinians. And they said, well, they're going to activate the Lebanese in a way that they haven't been activated before. So they're making it very clear. They're openly threatening, you know, the collapse of international shipping. Because if the Bab el-Mandeb and the Strait of Hormuz are completely stopped, clogged up, completely, 100%, this would immediately create a massive crisis. And gas prices are going to skyrocket, and millions of people are going to suffer. And this is just because they insist on committing mass state-sponsored terrorism against Lebanese civilians. And so now it's all come to a head. If you are supposedly MAGA, MAGA equals Donald Trump. That's what they told us, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, MAGA equals Donald Trump. That's what they kept telling us. You got to do whatever Donald Trump says. Okay, well, Donald Trump is trying to make a deal. Now, the Israelis are openly saying we need to tell Donald Trump no, and he's not allowed to make decisions for us, and that we need to force this war to escalate against Lebanon. And again, militarily speaking, the reason why they're doing that, just so everyone understands, is because they cannot find the Hezbollah fighters. They don't know where they are. They have no way to target them. So if you're in the Israeli Air Force and Bibi Netanyahu says, you know, do something about it, well, you literally can't. There's nothing to bomb. They don't know what to bomb. There's no power plants in Lebanon. You can't even bomb a power plant. There's no power plants. They've already destroyed everything in Lebanon for decades and decades and decades. And so every four or five houses in Lebanon has pooled their money together and bought a big heavy-duty generator. And so Lebanon is the only country in the world that has a truly decentralized power grid that literally cannot be stopped. And so way back in the beginning of this war, remember, I told you, they're going to end up having to use tactical nuclear weapons. And then when that doesn't work, and when the Lebanese people don't surrender, even after massive casualties, they're going to have to escalate to biological weapons or chemical weapons.
They literally just have to kill everybody. We got to go to break. We'll be back in 90 seconds with more. I think Israel's kind of screwed. I think they might be kind of screwed. Alex Jones Network. Go to thealexjonesstore.com to support us. AlexJonesLive.com. Share that link. We're here with Lebanon John talking about what is going on in the Middle East. But I have another video that just broke, John. I have another video I'd love to get your input on. It's very much related to what we're talking about here. It is the president of the World Jewish Congress, Ron Lauder, giving a speech about what he thinks the next step for the Jewish diaspora should be and how they are basically weaponizing Israeli intelligence against everybody everywhere in the world. So, again, this is the heir to the Estee Lauder fortune. He also just so happens to be the father-in-law of the newly minted head of the Federal Reserve. So isn't that a coincidence? Isn't that interesting? Isn't that perfectly in line with the protocols of the Elders of Zion? So here's an Elder of Zion himself, Ron Lauder, head of the World Jewish Congress, which shouldn't exist, talking about using Israeli military intelligence against their fellow American citizens. Let's watch.
Israel must create a new Iron Dome to not just fight this never-ending cascade of lies, but it also must go on the offensive. There should be a completely new and vitally important government operation with a new director, not just a political appointee. but someone who knows PR and news backwards and forwards. It should be a separate building. It should have a billion-dollar budget. Some of the billion dollars should come from Jews in the diaspora. Diaspora Jews should partner with Israel in this PR fight, because in the end, it won't be just protecting the Jewish state. It'll be protecting the Jewish people worldwide. And Israel should use its excellent intelligence services in this fight. The Mossad and Shin Bet are second to none, and they must know where these lies are coming from. It just makes sense to use them in this fight, and it should be one day in, day out. When Israel is hit with lies, Israel should hit back twice as hard. Its response should be furious. It should counterattack every single hour of every single day. And no institution should be spared. And there should be a special investigative section that investigates the old sacred cows like the UN.
Well, there you go. You know, you know what the problem is, John? People don't like Israel because they haven't spent enough money telling us to love them. That's the problem. You look around the world today, you think, why? What is it? What could it possibly be that would make people dislike Israel and, by extension, Jewish people who support Israel? Obviously, they just need more money. Obviously, if they spent more money, if they had greater control over what we're allowed to see and think, then we'd all love them. John, that's obviously the right solution. So that's President.
Yeah, I've been lying. See, I've actually been lying, according to him. It's actually lies to quote their own government policy. That, you know what I mean? Nothing I've said has been even debatable. Like, you can't, there isn't even a gray area. They literally cannot kill Hezbollah guys because they cannot see them. They are literally 100% factually opposing Donald Trump's lead openly.
Yeah, well,
Trump had to call Bibi Netanyahu.
Let's quote Ben Gavir here. Ben Gavir, everybody knows, you know, Ben Gavir. He's one of the, like, you know, two or three, probably the most despicable people on the planet right now, probably the most hated people in the world. You probably have, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu, Ben Gavir, and Bezalel Smotrich. Ben Gavir, the guy who runs around with a noose pin on, you know, just reveling in his ability to inflict pain on innocent people. That guy, Ben Gavir, said this to Netanyahu. He says, Mr. Prime Minister, you said a strong prime minister says yes to the president of the United States when it's possible and no when it's necessary. It's time to say no to our friend, President Trump. It's time to do what is necessary and what is required to strike a blow to Hezbollah, free our fighters, and restore security to the North. Israel and U.S. at odds on Lebanon. Israel seemingly admitting soldiers have been captured in Lebanon. So, yeah, that's Ben Gavir literally saying in no uncertain words, it's time to say no to Trump. Essentially, screw Trump. We're going to do it anyway. So just to clarify what you're saying there.
Yeah. So, unfortunately, you know, Donald Trump and Iran, it looks like they were making a pretty good deal, honestly. And Israel said they're going to not listen and they want to ruin it. And then Donald Trump had to personally intervene, which is like unprecedented for him to attempt to communicate directly with Hezbollah, for the president of the United States to specifically reach out and attempt to directly negotiate with the world's most powerful non-state actor, a, you know, resistance organization, and tell them, I mean, what could he even tell them? Hey, if I get Israel to back off, can you guys, you know, stop attacking them? They're going to be like, well, yeah, if Israel stops attacking Lebanon, of course we'd stop attacking them. That's what we've been trying to achieve this entire time. Like, what do you think we existed for? That's why Hezbollah exists. Hezbollah exists because Israel aggressed Lebanon. That's how Hezbollah came to be.
Right.
I'm sure the Hezbollah side was like, yeah, of course, if you can make Israel stop killing people, we would stop hitting Israel, of course. And so Donald Trump, Bibi Netanyahu told Donald Trump that, all right, he's going to back off. But then there's confusion in the Israeli camp here where, okay, they might not be permitted by the United States to flatten Dahiyat, to flatten the suburbs of Beirut, which is far from the border, far from the fighting. Okay, they might not be permitted to do that. But what about the south of Lebanon that they're actively doing military operations in daily and actively getting blown up in? daily. What are they supposed to do there? And there's confusion in Israel about that. And that's why there's outrage on the Israeli First team and just the general Zionist team right now, outrage against Donald Trump, because they're saying, we don't want to ask Donald Trump permission for our national security objectives, or, you know, in the middle of a military operation, then we have to stop it when we're losing. That doesn't really make any sense. And so from the Israeli point of view, they're very upset right now. And again, this is the perfect time to take this question straight to all of these Israel firsters here in the United States and tell them, I thought you supported President Trump. I thought we were the panicans. I thought we were turncoats and we're not the real MAGA. Well, we want this deal because we want the war to end. We want the gas prices to go down, and we want Donald Trump to focus on domestic issues and on the economy. And so we want this deal to go through. We don't care about regime change in Iran. It doesn't look like they can even achieve a regime change in Iran. So we don't care about that. We're done with that. So we want America first. Okay. And Donald Trump now has taken actions that align with that, with the original MAGA base. Well, he dug himself into this hole in the first place, but putting that on the side, regardless, right now, he's taking actions that align with MAGA. These MEGA guys, these MEGAs, well, now they're against that. And why is that? Wouldn't that imply, now I'm going to say the unspeakable thing that could put me in jail now, where, what, you know what I'm saying? Maybe I shouldn't say it. If you haven't figured it out by now, then maybe I shouldn't even say it.
Well, I've said many times that Hezbollah is the American dream. So I don't know. I don't know what you're trying to say, but I believe Hezbollah is a militia movement that I'm jealous. I wish we had one here in America that was as robust and powerful as Hezbollah is. I'm not sure where you were going with that, but that's how I feel about it personally.
Well, we should learn from what works from all the different cultures in the world, and obviously. They have things that work, okay? They opened up nonprofit co-op grocery stores for the poor. They can give interest-free loans. They have their own banking system that doesn't rely on usury. They have their own hospital services. I mean, there's a lot of things that are very nationalistic that we could totally learn from this organization. But unfortunately, one of the most important things is leadership. Their leadership is hidden and secret because otherwise, you end up with what we have with Donald Trump, where everything seemed great. It was going on the right track, apparently. And then God knows what happened. You know, they co-opted him. He was, you know, secretly working for them the whole time, or they have some way of controlling him, some way of threatening him, some way of blackmailing him. Nobody really knows. And so when you're fighting this, you know, extremely powerful monolithic conspiracy, at the end of the day, whoever is going to be the leader against these people, he probably can't just be out in the open. And that's the main lesson from these guys in Lebanon that people are going to have to learn in America, because they are just going to take out public figures and eliminate them, like in politically, reputation wise, economically, financially, or even physically, because they can do that. And so, you know, to truly resist them, you know, it does require a level of sophistication, which we have not yet seen in the United States. So who knows how that's going to happen or how that's going to play out. How many people have to die before we realize what exactly we're up against? But, you know, I think they've threatened Donald Trump. I think that they have Donald Trump, you know, in a tight situation. And, you know, think about it. They could release an AI video of Donald Trump doing something sexually horrible to a minor, and it could be AI. And they've ruined his reputation, that literally it could be AI and it wouldn't matter. And they could tell him, hey, we'll just release this and destroy you. And it's that easy. So right there, I just gave you a hypothetical that is extremely easy and extremely realistic and feasible of how with one simple act, they could destroy Donald Trump. They've already got him, you know, by the balls because of the situation.
What do you think about that? Because I think obviously you're right. I mean, we can speculate as to, you know, what exactly happened with Trump, but I think they made a deal with him. I think they simply made a deal with him. And because, you know, look, you've got stuff like this today. This is from ProPublica.org, right? For some reason, I'm not seeing this article on any of the mainstream news outlets, which you would think you would. The White House intervened to get a $620 million deal for a company tied to Donald Trump Jr. This is just one of the, like, innumerable examples of Donald Trump and his family making literally billions of dollars off of, you know, government contracts or, you know, betting on how the war would progress or whatever else. They are acting in an openly corrupt way, and yet the media is not reporting on it. The media, who has gone out of its way for the last 10 years, Donald Trump has been in the public eye to not just blow every single hint of a scandal out of all proportion, but to fabricate scandals whenever there were, you know, they had some downtime. Now, Donald Trump has, like, instance after instance after instance exposed of him or his family members being corrupt, and yet nobody reports on it. Nobody is making a big story out of it. I mean, how does that happen except that they like what Trump is doing, and so they're holding off the criticism? And, of course, extend that to the crimes that he was charged with during the interregnum, you know, in between his two administrations. You know, they're going, look, that's either going to happen to you again, or you can work with us and, you know, sail off into the sunset with tens of billions of dollars. I think it's pretty clear he made a deal. When that deal happened, I guess, is sort of up for debate. Here's a theory.
Well, it's probably when he agreed to go to war with Iran. I mean, that's obviously what they were requesting from him. But so what you're saying is that Muslims control the media?
That's what yes. I think that at the end of the day is pretty obvious, right? It's the Qataris.
Yeah, it's got to be what it is.
It's got to be the Qataris, of course. So again, just to lay out the timeline here, and this is like amazing because it's all within minutes, right? These are all from Mario Nofal, and most of them at least. 12:45 p.m. today, Trump just declared a full ceasefire in Lebanon. After his declaration of lifting the blockade over Iran, I learned to ignore everything he says and wait till facts on the ground play out, especially when it comes to Israel. So Donald Trump on Truth Social, I had a very productive call with Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu of Israel, and there will be no troops going into Beirut, and any troops that are on their way have already turned back. Likewise, through highly placed representatives, I had a good call with Hezbollah, and they agreed that the shooting will stop. Israel will not attack them, and they will not attack Israel. So that was 12:45. 12:48. Israeli Air Force striking at Nabatay in southern Lebanon. The announcement ceasefire isn't holding up too well. Literally 3 minutes later, Israel is bombing Lebanon. Hebrew media: Israel is confused by Trump's ceasefire announcement and has no knowledge of such agreement, of any such agreement. At most, they say, there was an understanding not to strike Beirut, nothing about southern Lebanon, nothing about a mutual halt. IAF is still striking at Nabatay. Missile alerts are still going off in Israel. And that's 12:51. So from 12:45 to 12:51, you have a announcement and then complete collapse of the ceasefire agreement. And finally, Israel's Netanyahu orders attacks in Beirut's southern suburbs. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu ordered the attack on the Hezbollah-controlled southern suburbs in Beirut on Monday, signaling the risk of further escalation in a war that has complicated mediation towards resolving the U.S.-Iran conflict. So, again, it's like it's not up for debate. This is just what's happening. Trump is trying.
Oh,
it
yeah.
seems to get peace, and Israel is screwing it up. It's not that complicated.
No, 100%. I mean, Donald Trump actually tried to directly negotiate with Hezbollah. I mean, that is unprecedented. I mean,
that's huge. Yeah, that's crazy.
The last time the United States tried to communicate with Hezbollah, they actually told them that they would bring billions of dollars of investment into Lebanon and take Hezbollah off the terrorist list if Hezbollah would abandon the Palestinian cause.
Wow. That's American diplomats trying to use American wealth to bribe Hezbollah to stop attacking Israel.
Just to generally abandon the cause of Palestinian human rights, just generally speaking. Just the cause of basically liberating Jerusalem is really what it is. But it goes really deep, and it's very complicated, and it's very hard for people to understand. People have to understand that Jerusalem is the holy site of both Muslims, Christians, and Jews, and Jerusalem in the current moment is essentially governed or occupied by a Rothschild project. And so, truthfully speaking, from a religious standpoint, you know, that is not aligned with Judaism, Christianity, or Islam, right? They're just hijacking the brand of Judaism. But a true religious Jew does not think that the Rothschilds represent them. That is totally ridiculous.
Absolutely.
So that's why, you know, this is a religious thing. There's no billions of dollars in the world that would make religious people accept a apparently satanic organization running Jerusalem. I mean, that's why if people struggle to understand what's going on here, I'm trying to make it as simple as possible for them. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And of course, you know, we talk about the Federal Reserve being sort of the root of all evil. I'm all, you know, I always joke that your conspiracy theory is long enough, you just become Ron Paul, right? You just identify that's the head of the snake. And so when you talk about, you know, all of this crap coming from the banking institutions and the banking combines and the banking cabals, really what you're saying is this comes from the Rothschilds. The Rothschilds who set up this international, you know, banking system in the, you know, 1800s or even before in the 1700s. They are the funders of Israel. They are sort of pulling the strings behind the British Empire and have since World War One. I mean, you know, I don't know why the regular, you know, Jewish person down the street feels the need to defend these, you know, ruthless industrialists that are just as happy to kill them as they are to kill anybody else that's in their way. But because they've cloaked they've cloaked themselves in the, you know, historical trauma of the Jews and said, you know, you're basically doing the Holocaust again if you criticize this giant control system we're erecting all around you. It seems right, so clear to me, but it all gets confused with the anti-Semitism claims.
That's right. And it's important for people to remember that the rumors or the word on the street is that the Rothschilds ruling out of the city of London have a chair at their grand table for Satan himself, that the Rothschilds are openly aligned with Satanism. And they've been involved in Western imperialism for a while now. And they, you know, John Kerouac recently told a story of how David Rockefeller went to receive a trophy from the bankers in a big meeting in Saudi Arabia. But that was the cover story for his real mission, which was to go and tell Saddam Hussein that if you don't cut it out, we're going to bomb, you know, we're going to bomb you. And so Saddam Hussein was their pet project until he went off the reservation, went off the plantation. And it was the Rockefellers who were running that. It was the Rockefellers who made the decision. Because again, and who in the United States made the decision to do 7 countries in 5 years? Who in the United States made the decision that Saddam Hussein's Iraq would be the one we'd invade after 9/11? Nobody can answer that. Nobody can answer that. And no one has any explanation for why they selected this country or what is the plan exactly. It's the Rockefellers. It's the Rothschilds. It's all of these groups who are in line above the bankers, actually. So anyway, we're getting off topic here, but right now, Americans need to be, you know, pissed off if this ceasefire fails, because if they block the Bebel Mendeb and they escalate this war, it'll be directly because of Israeli interference in American foreign policy. There's no question about it. It would be directly their fault, and we'll all suffer economically tremendously because of it. And that's exactly where we're at right now. So there's a huge difference between Israel first and America first, and it couldn't be more clear as it is exactly right now today.
Yep, and you know, it's just total 100% confirmation of what Joe Kent has been saying the entire time, which is if you want peace in the Middle East, the first thing you got to do is restrain Israel. And we've seen that reaffirmed every single time. We seem to be on the cusp. We seem to be about to achieve a ceasefire. Israel comes in, and because we apparently do not have the ability to alter their plans whatsoever, unless Donald Trump literally personally begs Netanyahu, and then even then it doesn't happen. So, you know, obviously we got to restrain Israel. We got to reject Israel's control of our foreign policy, and we have to just, you know, reclaim America and our foreign policy for us again. I mean, this is outrageous. Netanyahu has presented President George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Joe Biden with plans to attack Iran, all of whom have refused before Trump agreed. Trump also refused in his first administration. That's why now I'm working on the theory that it was Butler. What do you think about this theory, John? We only got 2 minutes, but I was looking at Trump. I was trying to figure out when exactly he changed. And I was thinking, what if it was Butler? What if they literally shot him in the ear with like a robotic, you know, an AI aiming sniper rifle? Because I was thinking about, I was like, the dude's running around on the roof. Either this was just terrible, you know, OPSEC, which we always knew that could be a possibility. But maybe that was a distraction. Maybe there was like a, you know, an AI robotic aiming device to where, because again, when you see Trump change and the dramatic change that is under, that he's undergone, the only thing I can picture is something like them shooting him in the ear and then showing him like the video of them doing it and going, do you understand? Do you understand that we control Secret Service? that we have the ability to blow your head off at any moment and then pin it on Iran whenever we want. Do you understand what we're capable of pulling off? Because if they're capable of pulling that off, I could see Trump going, you know what? That was scary. I don't want to get shot in the head, actually. I think I'll go along with it. Yes. I'm just throwing things out here. What's your thought on that?
Well, some people have found video footage of an extremely high-velocity drone that was flying around at Butler. And so it's possible that this drone flying by could graze him, or it's possible that it was entirely fake and just like WWE, where he went down and came up and acted like he got shot, or they intentionally missed him by a little bit. But there's no doubt about what happened afterwards. What happened afterwards is they told him that it was a divine intervention specifically so that you would go to war with Iran. That's what they told him. They told him that, you're preserved for a divine purpose. And they've gone further and just recently come out and said, if you continue the war with Iran, then you will win the midterms, which is exactly 100% the opposite of reality.
But they can pull the strings, John, so who knows? I got a lot of videos to show you. I'm going to try to get to as many as I can here. A lot of stories over this weekend that we haven't even touched on, including the chaos in Paris after a World Cup win, when a bunch of non-French people have an excuse to riot and burn things. And boy, do they take it. We can go to clip number 15 here. This is I've got 15 videos of this chaos, but this is, I think, the only one you need to see. Clip number 15 from Radio Genoa, Paris Burns. Let's watch. That's it. That's modern France. Eiffel Tower in the background. Sounds like gunfire going off. Fires burning and not a Frenchman in sight. Not a Frenchman to be seen. I should have grabbed it, but we're not going to spend too much time on it because it's just like, how much more do you need to see? How many videos, how many compilations, how many daily news stories about rapes going unpunished or entire communities participating in the most abject, horrifying crime you've ever seen? I mean, we're going to do it every day. Every day, we're just going to document the decline and fall. I would rather fight back. I'd rather be reporting on the, upstart nativist militias cropping up. I'd rather be talking about the way that nationalists all over Europe are, taking over castles and using them as outposts to launch a revolution. Do you know there's more castles in Germany than there are McDonald's in the United States? Just saying, they're just sitting there. They're well-fortified buildings that belong to you, the people, and that will be torn down brick by brick if the current trajectory isn't changed. I'm just saying, if I was German, I might be forcibly taking over one of the many castles that you have just sitting there waiting for you. But that's just me. I'd rather report on stuff like that. I'd rather not just show you endless videos of the replacement migration happening absolutely everywhere all the time. But I thought that one video of the Eiffel Tower in the background was particularly informative. Lots of videos of them destroying Lebanon as well. I want to go to, I guess since we're on the topic of Europe and the attempt to reclaim it, there are a lot of people doing a great job of trying to reclaim it. Among them, Eva Vlaardingerbroek. And she actually came out with a video talking about this. And we'll go to that here because people are standing up. But it's basically a race right now. It's a race for the, non-suicidal white people in Europe to try to express their dissatisfaction with the way things are going, to have a political solution. And they're racing against the power structure, which is rapidly trying to make it illegal to do any of that, trying to literally make it illegal to politically oppose your country's destruction. And it's almost an arms race of information right now. And I'm not sure who actually is winning. Actually, let's go first. Clip number 39 here. This is Frank Wright. He was a guest on the Alex Jones Show last week, and he's been making the rounds and doing an incredible job. And this sort of goes back to, it's sort of everything, right? It's that Europe is being genocided as we speak. They are being replaced in their own countries. Any attempt to bring awareness to this gets shut down by the power structure. And in many cases, well, basically in all the cases, I mean, basically they're trying to do the impossible, which is advocate for their continuing existence without seeming racist when racism is defined as white people existing. Like, it's sort of incompatible. And once again, I feel the outrage and the, what would the term be? It's just like, how dare you and who do you think you are? That idea, you know, because you've got these people who are being told, hey, I'm British and my country is going away. It's being destroyed right in front of me. It's brutal how this is happening. And it's made my life tangibly worse. We're suffering and we need to fix it. And you have other people coming along going, ooh, sounds a little racist to me, but I don't know if you want to take that tack exactly. And in a way, those people are even worse than the Muslims that are actually moving in and actually doing the horrible things. It's the people that are stopping the average English person from just standing up to that that really, I think, deserve our contempt and disdain. Let's go to Frank Wright as he's basically being asked to care more about the Holocaust, the genocide against the Jewish people 100 years ago, when the person he's talking to won't even acknowledge the act of genocide occurring right now. And I'm glad Frank Wright doesn't take this and doesn't fall for the bait and, you know, actually handles this very well. Let's watch.
I'm interested in the cause of the nation, my people, not international causes.
You're pushing an agenda that actually puts Jews in danger in this country.
How much are they paying you?
No, come on. You're a Jew-hating anti-Semite. There is no genocide in Gaza. There literally
you
is.
You should be ashamed of yourself. That's
there is no genocide in Gaza.
And I'm saying that there are reasons, international geopolitical reasons, why people would be outraged at support for Israel.
That is textbook anti-Semitism. You should be ashamed of yourself.
You're ruled by something that looks very much like a fanatical crime syndicate that does things that destroys everyone's lives. What you get is chaos and war and open borders and mad slogans and the outright denial of reality. And it's not good enough because we have to live in the mess they made.
Just absolutely brilliant. And that is, I mean, I'm telling you, it's why everything seems insane. It's why I can't just come up here and go, there was a ceasefire agreement. It's been signed. The war is over. It's a reason I can't say there's going to be a ceasefire agreement, but these are the topics that they're still stuck on, but we're going to solve those. Like, because it's, you know, everybody's lying all the time. Everybody's lying all the time. Everybody is, you know, two-faced and deceptive. Everybody is screwing each other over constantly, and it makes everybody seem insane. It genuinely does. And, like, it should make you feel insane when you say it's wrong to kill babies and somebody says that you basically want the Holocaust to happen. It's an insane world that we live. That is an insane interpretation of what's being said. But that's considered the normal interpretation by these people. It's crazy. Genuinely insane. It's what makes people feel insane right now. You're told you're the bad one for not wanting babies to be killed, or you're a hateful racist motivated by white supremacy because you don't want a million British girls locked in dog cages and treated like not particularly appetizing meat, right? It should make you feel crazy. It is crazy, the world today. And it's because we got a bunch of liars and scam artists and scumbags ruling over us and acting like it's normal. It wouldn't even be that hard to deal with if everybody could acknowledge that what's happening is crazy, but half people are out there calling you crazy for noticing how crazy it all is. So, honestly, what we need to do is cut through all the rhetoric, cut through all the nonsense, cut through all of the, you know, inaccurate add-ons they add to any statement you make, right? If I say I don't like Israel killing babies, they like to rip that out of context and say Harrison wants Israel, you know, everybody in Israel to die a painful death. No, I just want the country as a political entity destroyed. It's very different. It's very different. We need to cut through the crap and just point out White people are being killed, white people are being destroyed by non-white people of every stripe, and that their own governments are really the engines behind this, and you have to stand up against it and fight back against it. And that's it. That's just what it is. They can call you all the names they want. At the end of the day, they're going to call you those names no matter what you do. So it really shouldn't even be a component of the decision. They're going to call you racist. They're going to call you evil. They're either going to do it while they're stepping on your neck, or they're going to do it while fleeing back to their homelands. The choice is yours. Here's Eva Vlaardinger-Brook, as well as several other fantastic European heroes, honestly, braving the most unfriendly legal and media environment in the entire world to tell the truth and try desperately to fight back against the relentless evil they're faced with. And they deserve all the support we can give them. Let's watch.
Europeans, it's 2 minutes to midnight. Right now, as you're watching this video, thousands of immigrants are pouring into our borders.
We are that close to becoming irreversibly and permanently a minority in our own nations.
I don't have to tell you what that's like. You know it. I know it. We all know it.
We have been talking about it for ages, but now it is the time to take action.
So today, we are presenting the first ever Patriotic European Citizens Initiative, the Safe Europe Act.
It's an official tool by the European Union, never been used by patriots before. It's a tool for every citizen to get involved into policy making and put their interests in the agenda of the European Commission. And today, we're going to do exactly that.
With the Safe Europe Act, we are demanding of the European Commission to take a stance on what matters most, acknowledging the ethno-cultural continuity of the peoples of Europe as crucial for its perseverance. We are demanding of the European Commission to install a total and full halt on non-Western immigration, both legal and illegal. From now on, no one comes in and millions go out.
We are demanding from the European Union to end all pull factors, benefits, and create a harmonized system for voluntary return to remigrate every single migrant who is a threat or a burden to our society.
But to do that, we need your help.
If we reach the 1 million signatures, we are forcing the European Commission not only to meet with us, but to talk about remigration in the European Parliament. Now, we're not naive. We know that the European Union doesn't care about the future of the peoples of Europe, but we are not asking for permission. We just act and create a political crisis for the European elites.
We will let the right-wing parties do the fighting from the inside, and what we are trying to do is unite and move the force of millions of European patriots towards the institutions and put pressure on them from the outside. By hitting the 1 million signature threshold, we will legitimize our movement and we will force them to take a stance. They want you silenced. We want you to be heard.
The first step in our plan is the kickoff phase. We're looking for 100,000 early signers, ambassadors, and an avant-garde for the whole campaign to get the other 900,000 patriots to sign and to legitimize our demand for remigration.
Don't sit back and watch Europe get destroyed. Demand your country back, for yourself, and more importantly, for your children. Join the most important political campaign of 2026. Sign the Save Europe Act and join our movement.
Save-Europe-Act.com. That's save-Europe-Act.com. And, you know, watching that, I can't help but think that maybe the attempts by the European elite to silence the regular citizens has backfired. Because, you know, I don't think it's helpful necessarily to have the likes of Handsome Truth or even Jake Lang in certain situations, like being so abrasive, being so, because I hang out with normies, because I deliberately try to hang out with normies that aren't involved in politics, which is the vast majority of people in this country, the vast majority of people, 90% probably. They don't know who the Secretary of State is. They got no idea about any of this stuff. And you can say, well, they should. Yeah, I agree. But when they see somebody like Handsome Truth, frankly, you know, insulting and demonizing and belittling a, you know, random average Jewish guy. How do you think, you know, the woman that served you your coffee this morning feels about that? She might be a right winger. She might be, you know, hardcore conservative, but they're good people and they want to be good people. And they see people being mean to other people. They don't like that person. And so in a way, because the European activists and nativists and nationalists have to be so careful about how they phrase things and have to be so sort of perfect in the way that they act, they've actually really developed that muscle and they can actually, you know, operate in this controlled system in a way that's effective. And it's really powerful to see. And it's what I want to see here in America. I want to see more of. I don't want to see people yelling at, you know, random nobodies in the street. I want to see major political movements taking power in a real way to reverse the actual problems that we're experiencing. Even with the immigration stuff, I do think the immigrants themselves are bad. I think the immigrants themselves have committed a crime and are abusing us, and we don't owe them anything. And in fact, just you don't have to feel bad about defending yourself against an attack. So yeah, the illegal immigrants themselves, even the legal immigrants themselves who don't appreciate America and are trying to take us over, they are a problem. They are an issue. They don't, you know, it's not like they're unthinking beasts that are just at the whim of a larger system, but it is that larger system that gives them the opening, that gives them the ability to take advantage of us. So yeah, I don't want, you know, the community down the street in Texas to be a Muslim community with a mosque and with their un-American, you know, beliefs about women or anything else. But at the same time, I know it's the person in Austin or Washington that brought them here, and they're the ones who need to be confronted. And I really feel like we could do a better job of that here in America. But I also, you know, the more I cover these stories and the more and more and to a greater degree these attacks are racialized, the more I'm like having a hard time delineating between Canada and Britain and Australia and America, because to me, it's just, it's one thing. It's one thing happening to one group of people. And it can happen a little differently here or there, but same thing in America, right? Californians aren't non-American just because they're in California and I'm in Texas. But I can still look to them and go, man, California is really screwing this up for us. California is really, you know, hurting our cause. And the same way I'm thinking about nations around the world where I'm just like, it's an attack on white people. It's an attack on white sovereignty. And importantly, it's an attack on the concepts that white people originated and continue to be the sole champions of. Things like free speech, things like the liberties and great things about this country and this world that the liberals still enjoy but are trying to destroy. It all came from white people, and it's what makes us strong and resilient, and that's what they're targeting and trying to destroy. So I have a hard time even seeing, you know, this is separate where it's like, well, this is happening in the UK and they deserve it. They don't deserve it. France doesn't deserve it. The Germans don't deserve it. None of us deserve it. And we're all in it together. So I don't know how we bring that about, but the Jews have the diaspora. We need something like that. It could be called the Imperium. That's my concept. And the other thing that you have to understand is that, like, it's not going to be hard. It wouldn't be hard. The hardest thing to do is to overcome the mental limitations that people have of recognizing what's actually happening and confronting it or contending with it in a reasonable way. The numbers that have come out recently about the way our country has been sold out from under us and how long it's been going on should, on one hand, shock and infuriate you to know that it's been like this for so long, but on the other hand, make you really impressed with white people, folks, really impressed with Americans. So from leading report, foreign-born workers have accounted for more than half of U.S. labor force growth since 2007, folks. 2007. For the last 20 years, half of the jobs in this country have gone to foreigners, half of them. And then starting about, you know, 5 years ago, they really slammed their foot on the gas. 9 out of 10 new American jobs since COVID have gone to somebody born outside of the United States. So it went from 50% overall since 2007 to 9 out of 10 jobs given to foreigners in the last 5 years. From Gregory Bovino, foreign workers driving over half of U.S. labor force growth. Rhinos write loopholes for corporate cheap labor while Democrats open the borders to import voters. Both sides win. Americans lose. Wages down. Housing demand up. No wonder our kids can't buy homes. The mass importation is a direct attack on affordability. More people, same houses, and exploding prices. Classic uniparty math. Stop importing our replacement and instead put Americans first. They'll call it racist. It's just supply and demand with consequences. On the other hand, white people are still doing great. Here's the flip side of the coin. We've been ruthlessly discriminated against for my entire life, and most white people haven't even noticed yet. Isn't that crazy? White people have been like the victim of state-sponsored oppression for my entire lifetime. And yet most white people you talk to are not even aware that they're discriminated against whatsoever. That's how powerful white people are. That's the silver lining of all these clouds that talk about how white people have been systematically discriminated against for decades on end. The flip side of that is we haven't even noticed. So I really want you to think about, like, what would happen if we tried? What would happen if there wasn't discrimination? What would happen if 100% of the jobs had gone to Americans instead of half? Where would we be if hundreds of billions of dollars hadn't been stolen from us through the immigration system? Where would our average white or black or Hispanic or Asian American citizen be if our country as a whole, our nation, and in particular the white race, had not been systematically attacked for the last several decades and discriminated against and impoverished on purpose? Would we be on Mars? Would we have a base on the moon? I'll tell you one thing, we'd have nicer airports. We'd have a lot nicer airports. We can go to this video, and we've played it before, but I want the crew just to keep this in their pocket. Like, just put it in a folder somewhere. We can always reference it. Let's go to clip 10 here and just roll it as B-roll, because this is the newest Chinese airport. It was built at the top of a mountain. Very hard to get to. And I believe it costs something like $4 billion. So let's go ahead and roll clip 10 here. Go and roll clip 10. And just so anytime we talk about billions, I want to just look at this and go, oh, okay, so the Somalis stole how many of these from us? Sorry, what's 9 billion divided by 5? Like, what? How many of these did they take from us? And we can just look at this whole thing. From top to bottom, from beginning to end, it cost China $4 billion, I believe. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Certainly no more than 6, but I believe it's $4 billion. Okay, maybe we just need to have this. So I don't want to hear, we're spending $20 trillion or $20 billion on Israel. I want to hear we're sacrificing the creation of 5 of these buildings, these incredible engineering marvels. We're sacrificing 5 of these. We could have 5 of these. 5 American cities could be home to top of the line, best of the best, technologically advanced, archaeologically impressive, or architecturally impressive buildings. What's the number? 7.8 billion they spent on that? All right. 7.8 billion. There you go. 1.22 million square meters, the equivalent of 170 football fields, making it 5 times larger than New York's Central Grand Station. Okay, so we only lost, 12 to 13 of these to Somali raiders. So maybe not as many as I thought originally. Now I want to go to, if we have time, I want to go to the video of the liberal who figures out what it's really all about. Clip 42 here. I'm going to have to save this for tomorrow. We're running out of time. We'll save it for tomorrow. I got a good video to show you tomorrow of a liberal who's apparently never seen the real world before and how they react. But you're going to have to tune in tomorrow. You're going to have to tune in right here on the Alex Jones Network at 3 p.m. tomorrow. If the crew doesn't spoil it first, if the crew doesn't just show it so you can go find it on X. You're teasing it. Well, you can go find the video yourself. What you're not going to get is my insightful commentary afterwards. You got to come to the Alex Jones Network for that. when I mock these people relentlessly. I hope you can support us by going to thealexjonesstore.com. We make it incredibly easy for you to support us. Massive discounts, incredible products. And just know that you're contributing to the single most fearless organization on American soil at this point. We will continue to tell the truth, regardless of who wants us to do otherwise. We'll continue to cover these major stories in ways that everybody else is scared to do. We'll do it all. We're all in on this. You have our commitment to pursue this to the bitter end. All we ask is you support us at thealexjonesstore.com, thealexjonesstore.com/Harrison, if you want to let them know who sent you. We'll be back tomorrow.